Harrisburg Community College, Tape 1, Side 1, We Came to Stay, Doubleday's Division, on the First Day by Charlie Fennell.
Yeah. We're supposed to have 30 people in here. We only have 27, so I'll leave the door open for a couple seconds. It might be like at the Baptist church. We might have the late sitting, you know, when they'll get there in time for the early seating. But my name's Charlie Fennell, for those that don't know me, and this is going to be a discussion with slides on Doubleday's Division at Gettysburg. So if you aren't in here for that, you're in the wrong room. Basically, I came across the idea of doing Doubleday's Division last year. Because most people, when you think of the first day at Gettysburg, you think of General Buford. How many know General Buford? You know, General Buford did all that good stuff. Held back the entire Confederate Army for days just so the Union Army could come to Gettysburg and make a fight of it, you know. But I think we have played Buford's role a little too much. And then if you know anything else about the first day, you might be Iron Brigaders, those black-hatted fellows, you know, which until we had the movie Gettysburg got all the credit for the first day. Now they have to share with Buford and the cavalry, which I think is a good idea. And then the other thing, if you know anything about the first day, you know the damn Dutchman ran, okay? So you have the fighting on McPherson's Ridge and the running of the 11th Corps, and then you get into the good stuff, you know, Chamberlain and Little Round Top and Pickett's Charge. But I think Doubleday's division did a great job on the first day of the battle and helped set the tone for the fighting, and is often overlooked. And one of the reasons I like it is because most of it is from Pennsylvania. So we got to give the Pennsylvanians a little credit for showing up on July 1, too. Okay? Now what I'll do, I'll go shut the door and make sure we don't get any interlopers here. We have some people probably decided that the donuts were better than the discussions, and they decided to stay downstairs. I'm going to turn the lights off so you guys, if you want to face the screen, go right ahead. These lights go down in a slow manner. That'll give me a chance to find where the projector's sitting. And you guys in the front there don't want your heads on the screen. You might want to, if you could move to maybe another table off to the left there, you might be a little out of the line of fire. There we go. Okay, as I said earlier, the discussion will be on General Abner Doubleday's division. Abner Doubleday's division is a relatively new one. What happened there?
Lights came back on.
I don't know.
There's a ghost.
I told the ghost to leave me alone.
That wasn't a ghost.
Jackson Wright. Maybe
it's voice activated. We might have to be playing with this all day. They got sophisticated equipment in here, and I'm not used to running it. My switches go up and down like normal ones. It's strange and unusual. But don't. I don't know.
Pull the plug.
I'll try another switch. It says open and close. I don't think that'll work. We might have to. This is all.
Push it twice.
I did it. Just kind of getting there. See behind us. Of course, this is the monument to Abner Doubleday at Gettysburg. And Doubleday is technically a division commander during the Battle of Gettysburg. However, as most of you are aware, because of Reynolds' promotion on June 30th to wing commander, Doubleday actually commanded the 1st Army Corps, and his division will be commanded by the senior brigade commander, General Rowley, Thomas Rowley from Pittsburgh. But for clarity of purpose, we'll keep referring to it as Doubleday's division so that we know what we're talking about. Doubleday's division actually had three brigades in the Battle of Gettysburg. There were the two more or less Pennsylvania brigades of Rowley and of General Stone, Roy Stone. To these were added a brigade of Vermonters who were defending Washington, D.C., which is a great job if you can get it. They were nine-month wonders, and their 9 months were about up when they were added to the Union Army at Gettysburg. Since they weren't used to all that hard marching, they didn't arrive in time to enjoy the fun on July 1st, 1863. They will join the division that evening on Cemetery Hill and will have a conspicuous role to play on July 3rd, in which they wheeled out and flanked Pickett's division as it was going into the the lines.
I'm beginning to say, now shifting down to office. Keep punching it.
Okay, so Doubleday's division, one of the things that struck me about it is its inexperience at Gettysburg. If you take a look at Abner Doubleday, now Abner Doubleday's a West Pointer, and he's been in the old Army. He graduates West Point about the middle of his class. It was a class of 1842. It was a class of some notoriety and some people that were very conspicuous in it. One of them will be a man by the name of Newton, General Newton, who actually replaced Doubleday's First Army Corps commander on July 2nd, 1863. But Doubleday was one of those guys that was in the old Army, stayed in it, had a Mexican War background, and was at Fort Sumter when the war began. He was a captain at Fort Sumter and supposedly fired the first Union shot of the war in response to the Confederate batteries opening up there at 4:30 in the morning on April 12th. So Doubleday's experienced. He's got all the right stuff, but most people think of Doubleday as the father of baseball. So he gets very, when you mention that Doubleday was at Gettysburg, they say, is that the same guy that invented baseball? And of course you have to say, well, yeah, that's who they blame it on, but we're not sure if he invented it or not. But Abner Doubleday will come to Gettysburg as the Corps commander. Now his division on July 1st is composed of essentially two brigades. And this brigade is Chapman Biddle. Chapman Biddle will take the brigade once Riley takes the division. The Biddle's brigade is four regiments, three of which are Pennsylvanian and one New York. The Pennsylvania units were organized in 1862 and had seen very limited service in the war today. I don't know, do we need the blinds closed, you think?
No.
Is that what that button does over there?
That's light control. The blinds are controlled.
Okay, because the lights kept coming back on, and I kept punching them.
Okay, well, you hit me off, and then it should stay off for you.
Okay, well, I hit it off, and then they go off and then come back on, but I hit it twice, and they're doing it.
Right, now they're okay now?
Yeah, they're okay now, yeah.
There's about 500 different electronic controls in the room.
Oh, I know. I thought I probably tramped on something that set them off.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. The 121st Pennsylvania is one of the earlier regiments in the outfit. They had seen some hard fighting in Fredericksburg, but the First Army Corps didn't participate much at the Battle of Chancellorsville. They were marching around between Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville for most of the action there. The 121st Pennsylvania. You notice the circle on the monument.
Spoke too soon.
Yeah. The circle will be the First Army Corps' emblem. It came back on. Yeah.
Have you checked the master panel?
Yeah. Oh, there's a master panel, too. See how this works? Come on in and join us. There, the lights are back on.
Anywhere particular?
No, well, just those this day, because you can't that. See past me.
Oh.
Yeah. Is that scary? Should I keep my arms? He says every time I raise my arm, the lights go back.
Yeah, that's what it is. Motion.
Is that you think that's what triggered
it? It seemed to coincide with that. No. Funnily, probably not, but that's what it seemed like.
Well, most of the effect was right over there.
But maybe it is.
Oh, see, there's the there. Sensor.
Yeah. Put something in the front
of it. They can't see me. You guys don't raise your arm, do you?
No questions.
Yeah, no questions there. Well, no, when someone has a question, the lights will come on. Okay, we'll see if that'll work. 121st Pennsylvania. As you can see, this picture was taken right after the battle. And the 142nd Pennsylvania, as the number implies, it's not as experienced as the 121st. And this unit didn't see any action at Fredericksburg and didn't see much at Chancellorsville either. So it's a fairly new outfit.
Cross-shaped monument.
As well. Probably the most inexperienced of the bunch is 151st Pennsylvania. This unit is known as the School Teachers Regiment because the Colonel McFarland, was a superintendent of a school in Juniata County, and Company B was originally composed of school teachers from that school district. I guess when the superintendent goes to war, if you want a job when it's over, you better go to war too. But there was only one company in the unit that had any affiliation with school teachers, but the whole regiment was collectively known as the School Teachers Regiment. They are due to muster out on July 27th, 1863.
So they're on their way out. They're a 9-month unit, and their 9 months are about up. Ironically, this unit is going to suffer some heavy casualties in the Battle of Gettysburg. There was a theory in the Army that when you're within a month of mustering out, you tended not to want to get shot much, you know? And a lot of these units were held in some with suspicion. How good is this unit going to be with only a month to serve? And a lot of times they were left behind to guard wagon trains or cattle or something like that because of their soon-to-muster-out status. This is the only non-Pennsylvania unit in Doubleday's division on July 1st. This is the 80th New York. And the 80th New York is also known as the 20th New York State Militia. And it was organized in 1851 as a militia unit. And it's from Ulster County. Originally, I guess, a certain Irish background to it. The circle up there, which we can't see very well, has the hand of Ulster on it. The unit was in the war in 1861. So of all the units in Doubleday's division, this is the most experienced of them all. And had seen action, of course, in the Army of the Potomac and other battles on the peninsula and other places as well. So this is the only experienced unit. Unfortunately for Doubleday's division, this unit joined the division on June 30th, 1863. So it had only been acquainted with the division for less than a day when the battle starts on July 1st, 1863. You see, after the Battle of Chancellorsville, as many of you are probably aware, a lot of two-year units from Maine, Pennsylvania, and New York muster out. And, of course, there was some question as to when the muster out date was. And this led to some confusion and some, a couple of units decided to just lay their arms down and wouldn't fight anymore. And then, of course, you had to kind of suggest to them, you're either going to fight now or we'll shoot you anyway. And they pick up the guns again. But the 80th didn't have a home. The units that it had been assigned to were two-year New York units that had gone home and left the 80th all by itself. So they stuck them with those nefarious Pennsylvanians, and here they come as the only experienced unit in Doubleday's division. They had seen hard fighting and hard marching, if you will. Now, the other division is commanded by Roy Stone, the 2nd Brigade of the 3rd Division of the 1st Army Corps. Roy Stone was from, the Clarion area of Pennsylvania, just northwestern Pennsylvania. And he had served initially in the 13th Pennsylvania Infantry, the famous 1st Pennsylvania Rifles, the original Bucktails. If you ever heard of the Bucktails, Roy Stone was the major of that unit. And the Bucktails had earned a certain reputation for seizing the initiative, for using their own aggressiveness, if you will, and were considered to be some of the best soldiers in the Union Army. With this in mind, the thought occurred to the Lincoln administration, if we have one regiment of Bucktails, what would we do with a brigade of them? And so Roy Stone was given the job of going back to those wild, woolly places in Pennsylvania and recruiting other frontiersmen to serve in a Bucktail Brigade. And so the second brigade here is known by the nickname the Bucktail Brigade. And two regiments, the 149th and the 150th, were recruited just prior to the Battle of Gettysburg. They'd been with the unit at Chancellorsville, but once again hadn't seen any fighting worth remembering. So those were what were called the bogus Bucktails, because the original Bucktails didn't like the idea of these guys stealing those tail of deer and sticking them in their hats. I was trying to get all the deer tail that the government shot this year, because then I could outfit an entire regiment of Bucktails. You see, that's the one problem. You can join the Black Hat Brigade, and it's easy to get in. All you need is a crazy black hat, you know, and you can get dozens of stores in Gettysburg. But go down there and try and buy a deer's tail. You know, go in and say, I want the tail of a deer, and they'll look at you like you're nuts, see? But they knocked down 936 deer on the battlefield the last 2 years, and those tails had to go somewhere, you know? And I was struck by the fact that, you know, if I was ever going to be a reenactor, I'd join the Bucktails, because you have to have a tail of a deer to get in, and that's a symbol of honor, because you just don't find those at the Walmart stores. And I was going over the battlefield with a bunch of kids on a bus one time. Some of you may know me as a licensed battlefield guy in Gettysburg, so I get out there and I see these crazy things, you know. And I was riding along with a bunch of fifth graders, and there was a dead deer that hit my car that morning, still lying by the side of the road. The guy in front of us in the Jeep stopped and jumped out of his Jeep. And he had a big knife in his hand. And the kids wondered what he was going to do to the deer. You know, I said, don't worry, the deer's already dead. Whatever he's going to do to it isn't going to matter. They were getting excited about this. And he ran out, and he picked up the tail, and he cut the tail off and ran back into his Jeep. See, a bucktail was born that day. You know? But this was a symbol. I'm serious. I mean, this guy, the kid said, he can't do that. I said, well, he's got a bigger knife than I do, so I think we'll just let it go. But the bucktails came across this idea when they were coming into Harrisburg. In fact, Roy Stone's bunch came down the Susquehanna on rafts. They got on rafts up at Rockhaven and rode the rafts down the Susquehanna here before they arrived in Harrisburg to be joined with the other units in the regiment. The outfit was in Clearfield, where they saw a butcher shop as they were waiting for the rest of the unit to congregate. And in the butcher shop was the hide of a deer. And just like that guy at Gettysburg, well, a couple years ago, went out with a knife and cut the tail off a deer, one of the guys waiting to go on the raft went into the butcher shop, cut the tail of the deer off, and stuck it in his hat. And the other guys that were standing there thought that was a great idea. So they went out and started cutting pieces of the carcass off and sticking it in their hats. And when they arrived in Harrisburg, the other guys that were going to be with them thought it was a great idea, too. And then they started looking for pieces of deer to cut up and put in their hats. So that's how the bucktails were born. But this, the 149th and the 150th, the so-called bogus bucktails, and the 143rd Pennsylvania would be the other unit attached to the brigade. This is the 143rd Pennsylvania's monument at Gettysburg. Sits along the Chambersburg Road where the unit will take position. This is one of the bogus bucktails, and unfortunately, of all the pictures I have of this monument, I had to put the one in. You can't see the bucktail in his hat up there on the right. Just one of those things you don't realize until you show it. But you see it says 1st Regiment Bucktail Brigade on there. And the other one, the 2nd Regiment of the Bucktail Brigade, is the 150th Pennsylvania here. And the 150th Pennsylvania is kind of a special unit. I think it's Company G. If you want to be in the war, be in Company G of the 150th Pennsylvania. The reason you want to be in Company G is because a fellow by the name of Abraham Lincoln likes you, and he wants you around where he is. And Abraham Lincoln, until 1864, doesn't get shot at. So the time to be where to be is where Lincoln is. And they were his bodyguards. They weren't with him, of course, at the Ford Theater. They didn't have room for the entire Company G of the 150th Pennsylvania, so they didn't get to go to the theater with Lincoln. And after he was shot, of course, they were out of the job and had to rejoin the regiment in the field. But the 150th had one company missing in the Battle of Gettysburg. Now, of course, the road to Gettysburg for the Doubleday's division began on June 30th, just over the Pennsylvania line. And basically, the division was, in a sense, the one that was expected to lead the march. But because of the need for speed, General Reynolds decided to advance Wadsworth's division instead, because they were already advanced a little bit to begin with. So Doubleday's division then would be the second to arrive. The march, of course, to Gettysburg was one of great interest to these men from Pennsylvania for no other reason. They're getting closer to home with every day of the march. They're headed from Virginia through Maryland to Pennsylvania. And one of the things that they commented on, of course, two things in particular. One, how nice the country looked. It was a war-torn Virginia. And the other thing, just how happy the people were to see them. You know, Virginians aren't too happy to see guys in blue uniforms. But Marylanders and Pennsylvanians are, especially when the Confederates have already been through the area and have appropriated certain goods and commodities for their use. So the Union Army was greatly welcomed, and one of the things that they noticed were people that lined the roads, especially when they go through a town, that would pass out, you know, baked goods and milk and cool water from the wells, and so forth, and particularly if they were handsome women doing, you see. They always noticed that, that where the young ladies were, that they were conspicuously singled out. Nothing raises a soldier's morale more than pretty women and home cooking. And the longer you've been in the Army, the more the definitions of those two terms change. But suffice it to say that these guys in Pennsylvania and Doubleday's division were actually, you know, getting excited about being in the Army again. They hadn't been excited about it much because they always read about how they lose to Robert E. Lee in the papers. But now they're getting a kind of a rebirth of enthusiasm as they come up. Unfortunately, the 80th New York had some problems. As they were marching into Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvanians would just lavish stuff on the Pennsylvania units, you know, all the cherries you can eat, the green apples, you know, water, milk, butter, you know, biscuits. And then when they found out that the 80th was actually from New York, well, they wouldn't give them anything. And these guys were upset until finally one of them figured out that they really don't know the difference between a Pennsylvanian and a New Yorker. We'll just tell them we're from New York, from Pennsylvania too. And once they did that, then of course they were got their share of the goods and the commodities. So the march to Gettysburg, of course, was not a very long one, but it was a hot one. And as one account suggested, that the men as they marched to Gettysburg perspired as they had never perspired before. Now, the temperature wasn't very high, but the humidity was. And they arrived on the battlefield at about 11:30 on the morning of July 1st. Now, if you know anything about the first day of the battle, you know the best time to arrive is about 11:30 because the morning engagement's already over. You know, the Iron Brigade and Buford have done their thing. They have stopped the Confederates out beyond the seminary that you see a picture of here, and have stabilized the line on McPherson's farm. So as Doubleday's division arrives, there is what is called kind of the noontime lull. There everybody's going for lunch. You know, they're going to the McDonald's and the Hardee's to get lunch, and there's not too much shooting going on at this time. Roy Stone's brigade was the first to arrive. And they came up the Emmitsburg Road like most of the First Corps did. They turned off at the Cadore Farm, went across the fields, now well-worn, because Wadsworth's division had gone across them before. So you could find there was a road just cut right down through the corn that led right here to the seminary. And here's where Roy Stone's men stopped to catch their breath, and the orders were given to drop packs. So you take off your pack, and that gets people's excitement because you know you're dropping it, because the next thing you're going to be doing is going into a battle line. At this point, somewhere at the base of the seminary ridge, within sight of the seminary, General Doubleday and General Rowley came to welcome the Pennsylvanians. And they welcomed them in a particular manner peculiar to them. If you know anything about Doubleday on the first day, most of the things you know is he had to stop and make speeches for every unit that came on the field. You know, he was kind of like the official greeter on July 1st, 1863. And, of course, here he stops and greets these Pennsylvanians and welcomes them, gives them a speech about how, you know, this battle means a lot, and if we lose this one, you know, we don't have to worry about the next one. So there was that little speech. Rowley, of course, is from Pittsburgh, Thomas Rowley. And he gave them a particular speech about being in Pennsylvania, their native state, and that, you know, these Southerners were carrying on in the most unacceptable way in Pennsylvania, and it was your duty to drive the invader from your native soil. And of course this fired the boys up, you know, and they started chanting, "We came to stay. We came to stay." And as they advanced in line of battle over Seminary Ridge, they were still chanting, "We came to stay." And of course this chant, as it rose in volume, got the attention of the Iron Brigade that was in the woods, and they looked around, and here they see these crazy guys coming across the field, "We came to stay. We came to stay." In fact, some of them are still there in the National Cemetery. All right, so they will fulfill their chant, "We came to stay." But this is a wartime photograph of the Lutheran Theological Seminary. Now, this ridge is McPherson's Ridge. And as they came up, General Biddle's men will arrive after Roy Stone, and his men will go into position here where the road is. Biddle's brigade did not come in the Emmitsburg Road. They took a different route to Gettysburg. They came up, the old Bullfrog Road, if you know where that is, and a road down along Willoughby Run, and for a time were actually behind the Confederate lines. And they were just sitting there on the Fairfield Road behind Harry Heath's division. And of course, if there had been a division commander with some initiative, or if Biddle had known where he was, he could have pitched into the rear of the entire Confederate Army, as it was on Hur's Ridge at the time, and might have changed the course of the battle. But he just sat there and waited for orders, and then he found out that he was further advanced than any of the other Union soldiers. So they turned on the old Fairfield Road and marched back to this position. So they were actually in front of the rest of the Union Army. And of course, as you can see, this position, there's not much cover. There's not much cover on the position. This will be the end of the Union line on July 1st. Now, Roy Stone's troops go into position along the McPherson's farm. And here's a picture of the farm as it existed at the time of the war. And the barn's still standing today, but all the other buildings are gone. This picture is taken essentially from the Chambersburg Pike, looking basically west. If you looked at the left of the picture, you'll see some woods there, and those are the woods in which the Iron Brigade found Confederates on the morning of July 1st. So as Roy Stone's men come up, they take up position at the McPherson Farm. Now, at this time, the Confederates are about a mile away. And as they see Stone's lines moving forward, they open fire on them. So his men began to attract artillery fire immediately upon arriving on the field. And, of course, a lot of them tried to figure out which building they were going to get to hide behind. And a lot of them went to these buildings and tried to find the spot to hide. And as you can see, there's four buildings. Don't pick the one there with the big hole in it, because you could get shot in that one. But the barn's good because it's got a stone foundation. In fact, if you remember the barn from ever being at Gettysburg, most of it's stone anyway. So Roy Stone hides behind the stone barn at McPherson's farm. That's the way the farm looked. Now, of course, this is the way the road looked. This is Route 30. And believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, you were charged to use that road. You had to pay a toll to use that road. There was a guy in Chambersburg who tried to collect the toll from the Confederate Army. As far as I know, they've never paid up. And we could fix a lot of potholes in Pennsylvania if we could get those Confederates to pay the toll with interest, you see. But this is the road, and in the distance you can see Hur's Ridge. Hur's Ridge, and that's where the southern line now is taking shape. And up there is a bunch of artillery, and this is taken from essentially where General Buford's monument will go at Gettysburg. And it's sitting right on Route 30. This is an 1880s photograph of the road, and you can see the open nature of the ground there. Look how open it is. So when Stone's men come up to the barn, they're exposed. And the artillery on that ridge, and the one building you see by the road, to the left of the road, is Hur Tavern. I'm sure some of you probably have tried the food there at Hur's Tavern. To the left of that ridge now is a development, you see. On the Union line, we have monuments, markers, and memorials, but on the Confederate line, we have fast food restaurants, motels, and condominiums. So I guess the Confederate line's better off today than the Union line because that's high real estate property, you know. Here's a modern view of it. And you see the barn here, the red roof? That's a bar and grill today. They built that to get all the college students out of the bars in town. But that's actually a place where you go get beer and pretzels and tavern fries. But if you look to the right where the cars are, you can barely see Hur's Tavern there, a little brown building to the left of the road. Notice how the road there looks just like the road here, except you can see the road here a lot better than you can see the road there. And this picture is taken from exactly the same place, as near as I can figure it out. So that's the modern view of it. Just to the left where it says one way, that's where the modern guide station is. That little stone house there that sits, and they have all those old relics standing out there waving traffic down. Here's another view of the road, and this is right after the battle. This picture was taken. The little house in the middle of the road, was hit by a tractor trailer truck. That little house was the toll house. That's where you had to stop to pay the toll. And the reason they put it there is because right behind it's Willoughby Run. And Pennsylvanians are pretty smart people when it comes to charging tolls. You ever been on the turnpike? You know? But the thing to keep in mind is they didn't have all these in and off ramps in 1863. But there's one thing that everybody needs to use. The bridge. Right? So all the toll stations were by the bridge. And you could sneak on or off anywhere you want because they can't stop you. But boy, if you want to use that bridge, it's 25 cents, please. And that's where the toll house is. That house no longer exists, of course. There is a house behind the big tree to the left of it that's still standing today. It's still standing on the street. And made toll house cookies in his spare time. I just wanted to see if you were listening. Now, this is a photograph that's in the Adams County Historical Society. And I believe that the year is 1885. And it's taken of the left flank of the Iron Brigade. This is the 19th Indiana. But if you look beyond the monument, you'll see Willoughby Run. And then you'll see the rise of ground beyond that where the Confederates are. When Biddle's brigade comes on the field, they were ordered to advance from the ridge down to the run. The idea is, you know, these guys fight in lines, and lines are supposed to be connected, you know what I mean? And to be on the ridge would be to be about 200 yards behind the 19th Indiana. So Biddle's men were ordered to march down to that open space across the run were Confederate sharpshooters and skirmishers. And they were in cornfields and in the woods, and they were also in some of the farm buildings that were there at the time. So Biddle's entire brigade moves down to this open area and are terribly punished once they get down there. There are some accounts, of course, if you will. This is an account of a man in the 80th New York. He said the field was alive, and the field he's talking about is that field across the run. The field was alive with them, and them being the enemy skirmishers. He said, in this ravine, and the ravine you see right there, where the run is, in this ravine the brigade found itself under a hot infantry fire and was unable to see the enemy from whom the fire came, and did not attempt to reply to it. So they march down there and they stand and get shot at, and they don't shoot back, is essentially what he said. Sounds like a real good idea to me. Gates, who is the commander of the 80th New York, believed that this was an untenable position. And he blamed the position on the division commander at that time, who was Thomas Rowland. And he said, during the fighting on the first day, the general commanding the division, Thomas Rowley, was hardly competent to judge correctly the conditions of things or to know what transpired on the field. In other words, this is a damning indictment of the division commander. Where is Rowley? Well, we're still trying to figure that one out. Rowley, of course, was brought up on charges after the Battle of Gettysburg for his conduct or lack thereof on the first day. And what he was being, shall we say, criticized for was the fact that he had indulged a little bit too much in alcoholic beverage. He was maybe enjoying the battle a little bit too much than he was supposed to. And there were other accounts of him reeling in the saddle. And then, of course, during the retreat, he's going to fall off his horse into Stevens Run. And then that just animated him more, you know. And he was covered with mud, and he was still reeling in the saddle. It's interesting to note that all of those people that complained about his conduct on July 1st were people that were not in his brigade. Now remember, the 80th New York has only been in the brigade for about a day. So they don't know how Thomas Rowley is. He's reeling in the saddle all the time, you see. He starts early and drinks often. And this didn't seem to, you know, this didn't seem to affect his behavior on other battlefields. But at Gettysburg, he comes under criticism. And then, of course, the 11th Corps will be the ones that prefer charges because during the retreat through town, Rowley, in his drunken state covered with mud, rode his horse into the middle of the 11th Corps and stopped him at an intersection and allowed his brigade to take the lead, and those 11th Corps guys were upset with him, as you can well imagine, you know. So you can see the 11th Corps didn't run the whole way through the town. They had to stop and let Rowley's men take the lead during the retreat. They were the ones that preferred charges. There, I have a copy of the court-martial of Thomas Rowley, and they had all his friends on the court-martial review board. All, you know, you name First Corps guys, they're on the review board. Wadsworth, you know, Doubleday, all these guys right down the line. And all of the charges were thrown out except for one. And the one charge that they stuck to him was conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. But all the charges of incompetence and cowardice and drunkenness were shoveled. And then he gets a good job. He gets to go off and sit on court-martial review boards for other people. And then was assigned to defend Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And as I always tell people, we did a great job because the Confederates never got to Pittsburgh. So Thomas Rowley is kind of interesting because he is removed under a cloud after the Battle of Gettysburg. It's interesting also to note that Roy Stone, the other brigade commander, after the Wilderness, is removed under a similar cloud for drunken and disorderly behavior in the Battle of the Wilderness. All right, so these two guys maybe have a little bit too much fun than they're supposed to. But look how open that ground is there. And this is Biddle's position on the field. Now, as they were down in that ravine, the ravine's over where the trees are, they were finally ordered to retreat and move back up onto the ridge where this picture is taken. And as they moved back, the Confederates moved into a farm out in front of the position and were using the building to shoot the people off the ridge. And so General Wadsworth, it was actually Wadsworth that ordered them down there in the first place. Wadsworth, who is the first division commander, he has nothing to do with these guys, but keep in mind, as they take up position, you have Doubleday's division on the left flank, you have the Iron Brigade in the middle, and then you have Roy Stone on the right flank. So Wadsworth's men are there, they're in the middle of Doubleday's division, and he seems to be given most of the orders on July 1st. So he came up the gates of the 20th New York and ordered him to seize that house. So Gates sent a company down back to the Run to take the Harmon farm. That's the farm that was down there at the time. All that's left today is the foundation of it because the Confederates are going to burn it on July 1st. Eventually, the Confederates tried to drive the Union troops out of the farm, and so another company of the 20th New York was sent down in advance of this position. So he actually had about, 60 Union soldiers in the farm. Guess who else was in the farm? Mrs. Harmon and her daughters. And they didn't like all this excitement around the place, and they were told to go into the basement. Fortunately, they got out before the house burned down around them, but they actually were in the farm at the time of the fighting, so not all the people left. So this is and they were down there for 2 hours. They're out in front of the Union line for 2 hours in this farm, fighting the Confederates on the other side of Willoughby Run. So it was a position of some danger and importance. Now, of course, Stone's men have the most difficult position. In the woods, where the gentleman is pointing, is the Iron Brigade. At least they have some cover. This picture is a Matthew Brady photograph. Some of you recognize it. Matthew Brady's the guy on the right taking it all in. And the guy is pointing to where General Reynolds was shot off. So I just saw General Reynolds. He didn't look too bad for being shot on July 1st, 1863. But he's pointing into the woods where Reynolds was hit. These are now known today as Reynolds Woods. But you can see there's those open fields there. And in the background, I think that's the Seminary Ridge over there in the background. Now, here once again is the farm. And I pay particular attention to the fence.
McPherson Farm.
Isn't that a great fence? You have to prop it up. And a lot of the fences were that way because after a couple of years of having the post in the ground, it rotted. And all that was supposed to do is let the traffic on the turnpike know that the horses aren't supposed to go in the yard and eat the grass. So all you need is kind of a fence along there. But along that fence were elements of the 143rd Pennsylvania and the 149th. During the law and in the fighting, as Stone's brigade was taking up position at the McPherson Farm, this gentleman arrived and offered his services to Colonel Wister, the commander of the 150th Pennsylvania. Does anyone recognize him? Yeah, that's John Burns. They supposedly have his musket here in Harrisburg. His War of 1812 musket that wasn't made until 1824. Okay, so if you know that story, then I don't need to elaborate on it. But be that as it may, old John decided to come out and fight. And John was, we looked him up. There are 9 John Burns in the War of 1812. So I suspect this is one of them, one of the John Burns. But he didn't see any heavy fighting. He showed up the day after the British left Baltimore. Now, if you want to show up to Baltimore, that's the day to show up, after Fort McHenry's been fired on and the rockets' red glare and all that good stuff. But he was a veteran of the War of 1812. It's just that, you see, he's a little too young to be soldier. He's nearly 70 years old, and Wister kind of laughed at him a little bit, made him mad, so the guy made up a story about how he's in one of the bloody battles of War of 1812. So Wister sent him in with the Iron Brigade. He said, you go down there and fight with the crazy fellas from Wisconsin. They're in the woods down there. You'll find them. So Burns goes down and fights with the Iron Brigade in the woods, and was actually, I guess the 2nd Wisconsin it was, or the 7th, I forget which one it was, actually mustered him in on the field because they didn't want to have insurance claims after the battle if something happened to him. So he was actually made a soldier by the Wisconsin regiment that he served with, and later on was given a pension by Congress. But there's a post-war photograph of John Burns. He was wounded 3 times and lived through the fight. But like I said, he was only 69 years old. Abner Doubleday saw him and wrote about him in his report. He said he said over 70. Somehow he got to be 72 all of a sudden. You know, all of a sudden he went from 69 to 72. But you can see he looks, you know, I mean, if you say he's 72, he looks it. If you can say he's 82, he looks that. He's actually in his late 80s in this photograph. But they have a monument to John Burns at Gettysburg. And the woods behind there is where he went in to fight. Basically, this monument sits on what was the 150th Pennsylvania's line, and the plaque on the front of it is taken from Abner Doubleday's battlefield report, which mentions this old fellow from town that came out to fight. And that report was what was used by Burns to get a government pension after the Battle of Gettysburg. He was given a stipend by Congress, and they also paid for his tombstone, which was put in Evergreen Cemetery. And there's his tombstone. See his wife's Barbara. How's that sound?
I like it.
That's a good name.
It's a good, strong name.
And Barb wasn't too happy with John because she told him, don't you go out there and get yourself shot. If you do, don't you expect me to come and get you. And that's all she said, and that's all she did. John got home in a junk wagon on July. Say, that's a hell of a way to treat a hero. But you see, if you go and mess with your wife, that's what you get, you see. John Burns, the date on the stone is 1794, to the left there under John. It's 1794. And basically that is his birth date. September 5th is the day. So if you figure that out and you minus 1863, July, you figure out he's 69 years old. He's not 72 or 74 or about 70. He's 69. This is the Evergreen Cemetery. In the distance is Big Round Top. I had to get a picture of the Round Tops in it. You guys be upset with me. So there it is. Take a good look at it. Now, back to the story of the fighting on McPherson's Ridge. As you can see, the line along this ridge, and this is a pretty good view, except for the snow, of course, and the modern highway, because there isn't much cover. Biddle's brigade is anchoring the left flank of the Union line on July 1st. And off in the distance is the Peace Light Memorial. And in the afternoon of July the 1st, Confederates come down from the north. They were trying to come to Harrisburg, but the roads were busy, and they couldn't get across the Susquehanna. So they turned around and went back to Gettysburg. You see, these were Jenkins boys and Rhodes division, General Ewell's men. Ewell was very upset because he wanted to come to Harrisburg. But General Lee would not let him. General Lee told him, you must come back because the Yankees are coming. And we need your help if we are to whoop them properly. You see. So he was a day away from coming to Hack and attending this program. He was just a day away. If there had been one more day's time, the Confederates would have marched down the center of town, and we'd have had a lot of good stories to tell about that, I'm sure. You know, they'd have pulled that Hart Trap monument down, I'm pretty sure about that. But you see, now you have these Confederates coming in from the north, and I want you to appreciate the problem that the men on this ridge have, except perhaps for the Iron Brigade, because they're in the woods. Biddle and Stone are exposed to fire from artillery from two different directions during this confrontation. There is a map that you have of the Confederates coming in to the left from the west initially, but then in the afternoon, they're coming in from the north, and those little lines off to the left there in blue are, you know, Doubleday's division and the Iron Brigade, and you see where the rest of the Union line is, it's back from there. So there's three brigades holding McPherson's Ridge on the afternoon. There's the oddly bird-like man. This is General Ewell, and General Ewell is the man who is trying to take Stonewall Jackson's place. He replaced Jackson after the Battle of Chancellorsville. Jackson was shot by his own men. Accidentally, of course, serious one stuff.
Side
you know,
two.
I mean, you get a Jackson biography, it'll fill a bookshelf. Lee will fill a bookshelf. Longstreet's getting there. Wendell gets his monument in Gettysburg this year. There'll be two, three, four more books come out on Longstreet. Jeb Stuart is a legend in his own right, who has his own bookshelf of biographies. You know, most of them written by the ladies, of course. But Ewell doesn't have a serious biography, and the speculation is it's because he was so characterized by the historians over the years that nobody takes him seriously anymore. They called him the oddly bird-like man, you see. And he had the beak of a bird and the eyes of an affronted owl, you see. And it got to the point where over the years, and when I do my Ewell discussion, I followed the genesis and transition of this story from Dick Taylor, who said that he had peculiar tendencies. He was trying to tell his kids about how strange old Ewell was and what a character he was, you know. And he mentioned that he looked like a woodcock, okay, because he didn't have a picture to show his kids. So he says, you see that bird out there, that woodcock, that's what old Ewell looked like. And from that, historians have run with it to the point where the most recent characterization of Ewell suggests that he didn't only look like a bird, he hallucinated he was one, and would sit and for times and chirp in his tent, and would only take sunflower seeds, you see. So I think, you know, historians have gone a little too far with this story of Ewell. But Ewell's men are in a perfect position to make life miserable for the Union Army on July 1st as they come down from the north. Now, this is a photograph of Oak Hill, but you see this line of memorials. This sits back on Seminary Ridge. And this is the rest of the 1st Army Corps taking up position to prevent Ewell's men from getting access to the rear of the Union line. Now, in the distance, look at this view. This is Roy Stone's position. Do you see the monument in the distance? Way up there, the little white slash above the snow? That's the peace line. And that's where Ewell's Rhodes Division comes pouring out of the woods about 12:30, 1 o'clock. And one account said, we heard this thunderous roar to the north. You know, and it was all these Southern boys letting them know they were there, you know, just out of courtesy. Hey, look where we are, look where you are. You're facing the wrong way, you know. So Stone's men are in this hinge. And what Stone had to do then was move men from the barn, where they were fairly secure, and form along the road there in that dip. You had two regiments, 133rd, 149th facing north, and the 150th is facing to the left. Now, the Confederates will attack from that hill. The most famous episode, of course, is Iverson's defeat. And as they're moving off of that hill, you might be interested to find out that as they move forward, the 149th Pennsylvania, which is right there on the other side of the barn along in that low ground that you see, opened fire on Iverson. And as their commander said, he said, we fire to the limit of the range of our muskets. And our fire on the line, he said, our fire had a tremendous impact on the Confederate line. Yeah, it did. Probably what they saw was those guys being mowed down by Baxter's men, you know. But they fired from here on Rhodes' division. The real problem, however, is Daniel's brigade. And Daniel's men kept coming across that field headed for the barn. So Stone's brigade will take on Daniel's men here on the afternoon of July the 1st.
So the 11th Corps isn't on the field yet at that
point. The 11th Corps is just coming up. Yeah, the 11th Corps is just coming up. And of course, that was part of the problem that Rhodes had. He didn't take into account the 11th Corps being on its flank. The 11th Corps is just coming up at this time, taking up position north of the town in those fields out there where the non-historic Ford garage sits today. Okay. But as Daniel's men came in, the 149th Pennsylvania advanced to meet them. And they advanced to the railroad cut, which is not the railroad cut that everybody goes and stands in, but the one to the left there of the, where the barn is. There's actually three cuts, two and a half now, but there were three at one time. Here's a picture of the railroad cut that everybody, this is the cut that was torn apart by the college. And then if you look in the distance, you'll see a bridge over a cut. And that's the cut on the morning of July 1st where Davis's men were trapped. And then there's a cut beyond that. But you see McPherson's farm off there to the left. Now, along the Emmitsburg Road is where the 149th Pennsylvania is. And as Daniel's men approached the railroad cut, he advanced into it. The 149th Pennsylvania advanced into the railroad cut and took up position. He said, and I quote from the colonel of the 149th, the men's arms resting on the bank of the cut with orders to take deliberate aims at the knees of the front rank of the enemy as he came up. So as Daniel's men approached the cut, these guys opened fire and did serious execution. Another account says, our men delivered a volley, then crossed the cut, loading as they went, and having delivered another volley, charged, driving the enemy over the fence in confusion. This is the 149th. Daniels will make three attacks on the 149th to drive them off. And on his second attack, Daniels' second attack, the 149th retreated back to the road where you see the farm, and Daniels' men crossed the cut and moved across the cut. The 149th then was ordered again to charge, and they charged across that open ground there and forced Daniels back a third time. And unfortunately, this time, crossed the cut themselves. And when Daniel's men got reorganized and advanced, they caught the 149th to the right of the cut. And many of the men, when they tried to retreat, ran to the part where the cut's real steep and couldn't get away. And they lost several prisoners and a lot of casualties because they advanced too far over. This is a problem of being new to fighting. You know, the veteran regiment like the 6th Wisconsin, they didn't go across the cut. They advanced to the cut and stopped. But if they were rookies, they'd have been all excited and chasing those Confederates to Richmond before you stopped them. That's the 149th, and they were driven back. Colonel Dwight lamented the fact that one of the problems he had with rallying the regiment was he didn't have the regimental colors with him. And one of the most famous episodes of the fighting on July 1st was the color episode of the 149th Pennsylvania. In order to draw the fire of the Confederate artillery from the unit that was around that barn, no matter which way they turned, they had Confederate artillery firing in on their flanks. He ordered the colors over to the cut, which was about 200 yards to the right of the regiment. He sent the flag carriers over there, and he told them, you guys get over there, wave them things around, and let them see you. And they did that. And guess what happened? All the artillery started firing on those flags. You see why the Yankees won? They cheated. But you see, this is something a veteran unit wouldn't do because they know those colors are important because they're the only thing you can see in a battle, and that's what the unit will rally on. If you don't have those flags, you can't control the unit. But Dwight didn't know that, you see. So he sent the colors off and then forgot they were out there. And then he makes this charge, and the regiment's looking for a place to rally, and there's no flags, and they just went to pieces and came stumbling back across that ground. Dwight still doesn't know where the flags are. You know, they're still out there. There's the color, the two guys carrying the flags, and then the guard that went with them. I think there's like eight guys out there, and they piled up some fence rails to get down behind because they're attracting all this artillery fire. It was a great idea. At least it worked for a time. As Dwight said after the fighting on July 1st, he said, I saved the regiment but lost the colors. Because when he was forced to retreat, he didn't even order the colors. He didn't even know where they were, and they didn't tell him to run. So those guys are out there the whole time, and the Confederates are closing in, and by the time they left, it was too late. Now here you can see the farm, and that's where the 149th was. They were aided by the 150th
McPherson's
party driving Daniel's men out in that final final effort. They drove them back. As Dwight said, after the battle, he said, the enemy's dead and wounded completely covered the ground in my front. So it indicates the hard fighting that they have. Now, the problem, of course, is that on the about 2:30, 3 o'clock, the Confederates on Hur's Ridge will begin the attack. This is Harry's second shot at the Union Army. And he brings his men across Brockenbrough's. Virginians will come right at you there where the 150th Pennsylvania is. And, of course, Pettigrew's big brigade will be to the left of that as you're looking at the photograph. And they'll strike the Iron Brigade in the woods and Biddle's men on the ridge beyond that. So this is the final assault on McPherson's Ridge. And as you can see here, you can see Rowley and you can see, actually, this one's actually wrong, this map. That's the trouble you get maps, and none of them are ever right. But there you can see this is the final Confederate advance about 2:33 o'clock on the afternoon of July the 1st. As one soldier said, as Heath advanced to strike the Union position a second time, about 3 o'clock it would initiate the fiercest half hour of fighting in the Battle of Gettysburg, if not in the war itself. And what he's talking about is the fighting for McPherson's Ridge, in which Doubleday's two brigades and the Iron Brigade are participating. The assault. As they move forward, you can see the fences. And this is where the 150th Pennsylvania was waiting for them. I just threw this in because, as you can see, there was a famous painting done of the final defense of McPherson's farm. And there you see the 150th Pennsylvania along the fence. And, of course, the casualties there. It's good to have a fence for rookies because you just say, advance to the fence and stand there and shoot. And that's what they did. This was such an important episode that after the war, Pennsylvania put it on their monument at Gettysburg. And this is the front of the Pennsylvania Monument. And right there is the fence and the barn to the left and the 150th Pennsylvania making its final stand on McPherson's Ridge. They, how many of you have been looked at the Pennsylvania Monument and didn't know what that was in the front of it? You're all looking at Nike, aren't you? Yeah, I know how you are. Looking for some tennis shoes. That's what you're looking for. This is the 143rd Pennsylvania making its last stand on Eastern McPherson's Ridge. And there you can see the color sergeant, Sergeant Ben Crippen, of the 143rd Pennsylvania shaking his fist at the Confederates. And one guy's going to whack him with the gun, and the other one's going to shoot him. So guess what? Don't take a fist to a gunfight. You see, Sergeant Ben Crippen is still missing in action from the Battle of Gettysburg. He probably is still at Gettysburg, and yes, he came to stay, and he did. The flags were recovered, but the color sergeant was not. He was beyond that. There was a great story. I think it was a story. I don't think, but Hill supposedly saw this guy shaking his fist, A.P. Hill, the Corps commander of the Confederate Army, and he said it would be a shame if a brave man like that was killed. I think that was, that was a post-war thing. But be that as it may, this brave act attracted attention after the war. And we needed Trianni to do this today. You know, he could do it with, he'd get that same guy he got in all those pictures holding the flag. And even if he didn't look like Ben Crippen, it wouldn't matter, you know. But this is a great color episode of the fighting on July 1st. Now, of course, here's a great photograph. And I took this out of the book that got me interested in the Civil War. This is that American Heritage book, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, this book, I had this book given to me by the librarians in my hometown when I was in the seventh grade. And I'm not going to tell you what year that was, okay? But it was just after the war, you know. The war, you know. And they gave it to me because I had two library cards completely full of my library card number because I kept signing it out as soon as I take it in. They told me I had to leave it sit there, so I take it in and let it sit there for like an hour, and then I go sign it out. B-1732 was my library card number, and there were two full cards of it, and nobody else could get the book, so they decided But since I liked it so much, they'd buy me a copy and give it to me so the rest of the town could use their copy. So I still have that copy of the book. But look at that photograph. And it's great stuff. Let me see if I can get up there, because this is the first, this is Doubleday's, this is Doubleday's stuff here. And I apologize because I can't get the original. It's in the private collection. But just to show you what's going on, look right here. Here's an American flag. These are the flags of the 149th Pennsylvania, remember? They were left out there, and when the line collapsed, they tried to make a run for it. This is the guy I know. He knocked that Johnny down. Now, he's not going to last too long. Let's look at all the other Johnnies coming in. But, excuse me, see the burning farm? See the burning, that's the Harmon farm. What I talked about earlier.
Harmon farm is burning in this picture that Charlie's showing.
Here's McPherson's Woods, which were really Herbst Woods, but that's where, you know, Reynolds was shot. And Stone said that as he stood there by the barn and looked, he saw a Confederate battle line that was over 2 miles long. Just rows of battalions, he said, on line with others in reserve. Look at this line. It's just long, long. And here's the Chambersburg Pike. See, here's the old color guard of the 149th Pennsylvania. They didn't make it, nor did their flags. But right here's the Chambersburg Road. Here is Seminary Ridge. Here's the seminary. Okay, here's the railroad tracks, right there. And here are the Confederates moving. But my name's Charlie Fennell, for those that don't know me, and this is going to be a discussion with slides on Doubleday's division at Gettysburg. So if you aren't in here for that, you're in the wrong room. Basically, I came across the idea of doing Doubleday's division last year. Because most people, when you think of the first day at Gettysburg, you think of General Buford. How many know General Buford? You know, General Buford did all that good stuff. Held back the entire Confederate Army for days just so the Union Army could come to Gettysburg and make a fight of it, you know. But I think we have played Buford's role a little too much. And then if you know anything else about the first day, you might be Iron Brigaders, those black-hatted fellows, you know, which until we had the movie Gettysburg, got all the credit for the first day. Now they have to share with Buford and the cavalry, which I think is a good idea. And then the other thing, if you know anything about the first day, you know the damn Dutchman ran. Okay, so you have the fighting on McPherson's Ridge and the running of the 11th Corps, and then you get into the good stuff, you know, Chamberlain and Little Round Top and Pickett's Charge. But I think Doubleday's division did a great job on the first day of the battle and helped set the tone for the fighting, and is often overlooked. And one of the reasons I like it is because most of it is from Pennsylvania. So we got to give the Pennsylvanians a little credit for showing up on July 1, too. Okay? Now what I'll do, I'll go shut the door, make sure we don't get any interlopers here. We have some people probably decided that donuts were better than we decided to stay downstairs. I'm going to turn the lights off so you guys, if you want to face the screen, go right ahead. These lights go down in a slow manner. That'll give me a chance to find where the projector's sitting. And if you guys in the front there don't want your heads on the screen, you might want to, if you could move to maybe another table off to the left there, you might be a little out of the line of fire. There we go. Okay, as I said earlier, the discussion will be on General Abner Doubleday's division. Abner Doubleday's division is a relatively new one. What happened there?
Lights came back on.
I don't know. There's a ghost. I told the ghost to leave me alone.
That wasn't the ghost.
That wasn't the ghost. Very good.
Jackson, right
there. Maybe it's voice activated. We might have to be playing with this all day. They got sophisticated equipment in here, and I'm not used to running it. My switches go up and down like normal ones. These are strange and unusual. But don't. I don't know.
Pull the plug.
I'll try another switch. It says open and close. I don't think that'll work. We might have to. This is all.
Push it twice.
I did. It's kind of good here. City behind us. Of course, this is the monument to Abner Doubleday at Gettysburg. And Doubleday is technically a division commander during the Battle of Gettysburg. However, as most of you are aware, because of Reynolds' promotion on June 30th to wing commander, Doubleday actually commanded the 1st Army Corps, and his division will be commanded by the senior brigade commander, General Rowley, Thomas Rowley from Pittsburgh. But for clarity of purpose, we'll keep referring to it as Doubleday's division so that we know what we're talking about. Doubleday's division actually had three brigades in the Battle of Gettysburg. There were the two more or less Pennsylvania brigades of Rowley and of General Stone, Roy Stone. To these were added a brigade of Vermonters, who were defending Washington, D.C., which is a great job if you can get it. They were nine-month wonders, and their 9 months were about up when they were added to the Union Army at Gettysburg. Since they weren't used to all that hard marching, they didn't arrive in time to enjoy the fun on July 1st, 1863. They will join the division that evening on Cemetery Hill and will have a conspicuous role to play on July 3rd. In which they wheeled out and flanked Pickett's division as it was going into the lines.
The Union said, now shifting down the hall. Keep punching it.
Okay, so Doubleday's division, one of the things that struck me about it is its inexperience at Gettysburg. If you take a look at Abner Doubleday, now Abner Doubleday is a West Pointer, and he's been in the old Army. He graduates West Point about the middle of his class. It was a class of 1842. It was a class of some notoriety and some people that were very conspicuous in it. One of them will be a man by the name of Newton, General Newton, who actually replaced Doubleday as 1st Army Corps commander on July 2nd, 1863. But Doubleday was one of those guys that was in the old Army, stayed in it, had a Mexican War background, and was at Fort Sumter when the war began. He was a captain at Fort Sumter and supposedly fired the first Union shot of the war in response to the Confederate batteries opening up there at 4:30 in the morning on April 12th. So Doubleday's experienced. He's got all the right stuff, but most people think of Doubleday as the father of baseball. So he gets very, when you mention that Doubleday was at Gettysburg, they say, is that the same guy that invented baseball? And, of course, you have to say, well, yeah, that's who they blame it on, but we're not sure if he invented it or not. But Abner Doubleday will come to Gettysburg as the Corps commander. Now, his division on July 1st is composed of essentially two brigades. And this brigade is Chapman Biddle. Chapman Biddle will take the brigade once Rowley takes the division. The Biddle's brigade is four regiments, three of which are Pennsylvanian and one New York. The Pennsylvania units were organized in 1862 and had seen very limited service in the war to date. I don't know, do we need the blinds closed, you think?
No.
Is that what that button does over there?
That's light control. The blinds are controlled.
Okay, because the lights kept coming back on and I kept punching them.
Okay, well, then, if we hit the off, then it should stay off for you.
Okay, well, I hit it off, and then they go off and then come back on, but I hit it twice, and they're doing
right,
it.
Now, they're okay now?
Yeah, they're okay now, yeah.
There's about 500 different electronic controls in the room.
Oh, I know. I thought I probably tramped on something and set them off.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. The 121st Pennsylvania is one of the earlier regiments in the outfit. They had seen some hard fighting in Fredericksburg, but the 1st Army Corps didn't participate much at the Battle of Chancellorsville. They were marching around between Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville for most of the action there. The 121st Pennsylvania. You notice the circle on the monument.
Spoke too soon.
Yeah. The circle will be the 1st Army Corps' emblem. It came back on. Yeah.
I don't know. Let me check the master panel.
Yeah. Oh, there's a master panel, too. See how this works. Come on in and join us. There, the lights are back on.
Anywhere particular?
No, well, just those this day, because you can't see past me.
Oh,
yeah. Should I keep my arms? He says every time I raise my arm, the lights go back.
Yeah, that's what it is. Motion.
Is that you think that's what triggered
it? It seemed to coincide with that. No. Funnily, probably not, but that's what it seemed like.
The motion detector is right over there.
But maybe it is.
Oh, there's a sensor up there.
Yeah. Put something in the front.
Maybe they can't see me. You guys don't raise your arms, either.
No questions.
Yeah, no questions there. Well, then when someone has a question, the lights will come on. Okay, we'll see if that'll work. 121st Pennsylvania. As you can see, this picture was taken right after the battle. And the 142nd Pennsylvania, as the number implies, it's not as experienced as the 121st. And this unit didn't see any action at Fredericksburg and didn't see much of Chancellorsville either. So it's a fairly new outfit.
Cross-shaped monument.
As well. Probably the most inexperienced of the bunch is the 151st Pennsylvania. This unit is known as the School Teachers Regiment because the Colonel McFarland, was a superintendent of a school in Juniata County, and Company B was originally composed of school teachers from that school district. I guess when the superintendent goes to war, if you want a job when it's over, you better go to war too. But there was only one company in the unit that had any affiliation with school teachers, but the whole regiment was collectively known as the School Teachers Regiment. They are due to muster out on July 27th, 1863. So they're on their way out. They're a nine-month unit, and their 9 months are about up. Ironically, this unit is going to suffer some heavy casualties in the Battle of Gettysburg. There was a theory in the Army that when you're within a month of mustering out, you tended not to want to get shot much, you know? And a lot of these units were held in some with suspicion. How good is this unit going to be with only a month to serve? And a lot of times they were left behind to guard wagon trains or cattle or something like that because of their soon-to-muster-out status. This is the only non-Pennsylvania unit in Doubleday's division on July 1st. This is the 80th New York. And the 80th New York is also known as the 20th New York State Militia. And it was organized in 1851 as a militia unit. And it's from Ulster County. Originally, I guess, a certain Irish background to it. The circle up there, which we can't see very well, has the hand of Ulster on it. The unit was in the war in 1861. So of all the units in Doubleday's division, this is the most experienced of them all. And had seen action, of course, in the Army of the Potomac and other battles on the peninsula and other places as well. So this is the only experienced unit. Unfortunately for Doubleday's division, this unit joined the division on June 30th, 1863. So it had only been acquainted with the division for less than a day when the battle starts on July 1st, 1863. You see, after the Battle of Chancellorsville, as many of you are probably aware, a lot of two-year units from Maine, Pennsylvania, and New York muster out. And, of course, there was some question as to when the muster out date was. And this led to some confusion and some, a couple of units decided to just lay their arms down and wouldn't fight anymore. And then, of course, you had to kind of suggest to them, you're either going to fight now or we'll shoot you anyway. And they pick up the guns again. But the 80th didn't have a home. The units that it had been assigned to were two-year New York units that had gone home and left the 80th all by itself. So they stuck them with those nefarious Pennsylvanians, and here they come as the only experienced unit in Doubleday's division. They had seen hard fighting and hard marching, if you will. Now, the other division is commanded by Roy Stone, the 2nd Brigade of the 3rd Division of the 1st Army Corps. Roy Stone was from, the Clarion area of Pennsylvania. Northwestern Pennsylvania, and he had served initially in the 13th Pennsylvania Infantry, the famous 1st Pennsylvania Rifles, the original Bucktails. If you ever heard of the Bucktails, Roy Stone was the major of that unit. And the Bucktails had earned a certain reputation for seizing the initiative, for for using their own aggressiveness, if you will, and were considered to be some of the best soldiers in the Union Army. With this in mind, the thought occurred to the Lincoln administration, if we have one regiment of Bucktails, what would we do with a brigade of? And so Roy Stone was given the job of going back to those wild, woolly places in Pennsylvania and recruiting other frontiersmen to serve in a Bucktail Brigade. And so the second brigade here is known by the nickname the Bucktail Brigade. And two regiments, the 149th and the 150th, were recruited just prior to the Battle of Gettysburg. They'd been with the unit at Chancellorsville, but once again, hadn't seen any fighting worth remembering. So those were what were called the bogus Bucktails, because the original Bucktails didn't like the idea of these guys stealing those tail of deer and sticking them in their hats. I was trying to get all the deer tail that the government shot this year, because then I could outfit an entire regiment of Bucktails. You see, that's the one problem. You can join the Black Hat Brigade, and it's easy to get in. All you need is a crazy black hat, you know. And you can get dozens of stores in Gettysburg. But go down there and try and buy a deer's tail. You know, go in and say, I want the tail of a deer, and they'll look at you like you're nuts, see? But they knocked down 936 deer on the battlefield the last 2 years, and those tails had to go somewhere, you know? And I was struck by the fact that, you know, if I was ever going to be a reenactor, I'd join the Bucktails, because you have to have a tail of a deer to get in, and that's a symbol of honor. Because you just don't find those at the Walmart stores. And I was going over the battlefield with a bunch of kids on a bus one time. Some of you may know me as a licensed battlefield guide at Gettysburg, so I get out there and I see these crazy things, you know. And I was riding along with a bunch of fifth graders, and there was a dead deer that hit my car that morning, still lying by the side of the road. The guy in front of us in a Jeep stopped and jumped out of his Jeep. And he had a big knife in his hand. And the kids wondered what he was going to do to the deer. You know, I said, don't worry, the deer's already dead. Whatever he's going to do to it isn't going to matter. They were getting excited about this. And he ran out, and he picked up the tail, and he cut the tail off and ran back into his Jeep. See, a bucktail was born that day. You know? But this was a symbol. I'm serious. I mean, this guy, the kid said, he can't do that. I said, well, he's got a bigger knife than I do, so I think we'll just let it go. But the Bucktails came across this idea when they were coming into Harrisburg. In fact, Roy Stone's bunch came down the Susquehanna on rafts. They got on rafts up at Lockhaven and rode the rafts down the Susquehanna here before they arrived in Harrisburg to be joined with the other units of the regiment. The outfit I think it was Clearfield, where they saw a butcher shop. As they were waiting for the rest of the unit to congregate, and in the butcher shop was the hide of a deer. And just like that guy at Gettysburg, well, a couple years ago, went out with a knife and cut the tail off a deer, one of the guys waiting to go on the raft went into the butcher shop, cut the tail of the deer off, and stuck it in his hat. And the other guys that were standing there thought that was a great idea, so they went out and started cutting pieces of the carcass off and sticking it in their hats, and when they arrived in Harrisburg, the other guys that were going to be with them thought it was a great idea, too. And then they started looking for pieces of deer to cut up and put in their hats. So that's how the Bucktails were born. But this, the 149th and the 150th, the so-called bogus Bucktails, and the 143rd Pennsylvania would be the other unit attached to the brigade. This is the 143rd Pennsylvania's monument at Gettysburg. It sits along the Chambersburg Road where the unit will take position. This is one of the bogus Bucktails, and unfortunately, of all the pictures I have of this monument, I had to put the one in. You can't see the Bucktail in his hat up there on the right. Just one of those things you don't realize until you show it. But you see it says 1st Regiment Bucktail Brigade on there. And the other one, the 2nd Regiment of the Bucktail Brigade, is the 150th Pennsylvania here. And the 150th Pennsylvania is kind of a special unit. I think it's Company G. If you want to be in the war, be in Company G of the 150th Pennsylvania. The reason you want to be in Company G is because a fellow by the name of Abraham Lincoln likes you. And he wants you around where he is. And Abraham Lincoln, until 1864, doesn't get shot at. So the time to be where Lincoln is. And they were his bodyguards. They weren't with them, of course, at the Ford Theater. They didn't have room for the entire Company G of the 150th Pennsylvania, so they didn't get to go to the theater with Lincoln. And after he was shot, of course, they were out of a job and had to rejoin the regiment in the field. But the 150th had one company missing in the Battle of Gettysburg. Now, of course, the road to Gettysburg for the Doubleday's division began on June 30th, just over the Pennsylvania line. And basically, the division was, in a sense, the one that was expected to lead the march. But because of the need for speed, General Reynolds decided to advance Wadsworth's division instead, because they were already advanced a little bit to begin with. So Doubleday's division then would be the second to arrive. The march, of course, to Gettysburg was one of great interest to these men from Pennsylvania. For no other reason, they're getting closer to home with every day of march. They're headed from Virginia through Maryland to Pennsylvania. And one of the things that they commented on, of course, two things in particular. One, how nice the country looked. It was a war-torn Virginia. And the other thing, just how happy the people were to see them. You know, Virginians aren't too happy to see guys in blue uniforms. But Marylanders and Pennsylvanians are, especially when the Confederates have already been through the area and have appropriated certain goods and commodities for their use. So the Union Army was greatly welcomed. And one of the things that they noticed were people that lined the roads, especially when they go through a town, that would pass out, you know, baked goods and milk and cool water from the wells and so forth, and particularly if they were handsome women doing, you see. They always noticed that, but where the young ladies were, that they were conspicuously singled out. Nothing raises a soldier's morale more than pretty women and home cooking. And the longer you've been in the Army, the more the definitions of those two terms change. But suffice it to say that these guys in Pennsylvania and Doubleday's division were actually, you know, getting excited about being in the Army again. They hadn't been excited about it much because they always read about how they lose to Robert E. Lee in the papers. But now they're getting a kind of a rebirth of enthusiasm as they come up. Unfortunately, the 80th New York had some problems. As they were marching into Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvanians would just lavish stuff on the Pennsylvania units, you know, all the cherries you can eat, the green apples, you know, water, milk, butter, you know, biscuits. And then when they found out that the 80th was actually from New York, well, they wouldn't give them anything. And these guys were upset until finally one of them figured out that they really don't know the difference between a Pennsylvanian and a New Yorker. We'll just tell them we're from New York, from Pennsylvania, too. And once they did that, then, of course, they were got their share of the goods and the commodities and so forth. So the march to Gettysburg, of course, was not a very long one, but it was a hot one. And as one account suggested, that the men, as they marched to Gettysburg, perspired as they had never perspired before. Now, the temperature wasn't very high, but the humidity was. And they arrive on the battlefield at about 11:30. On the morning of July 1st. Now, if you know anything about the first day of the battle, you know the best time to arrive is about 11:30 because the morning engagement's already over. You know, the Iron Brigade and Buford have done their thing. They have stopped the Confederates out beyond the seminary that you see a picture of here and have stabilized the line on McPherson's farm. So as Doubleday's division arrives, there is what is called kind of the noontime lull. There, everybody's going for lunch. You know, they're going to the McDonald's and the Hardee's to get lunch, and there's not too much shooting going on at this time. Roy Stone's brigade was the first to arrive, and they came up the Emmitsburg Road like most of the First Corps did. They turned off at the Cadore Farm, went across the fields, now well-worn, because Wadsworth's division had gone across them before. So you could find there was a road just cut right down through the corn that led right here to the seminary. And here's where Roy Stone's men stopped to catch their breath, and the orders were given to drop packs. So you take off your pack, and that gets people's excitement because you know you're dropping it because the next thing you're going to be doing is going into a battle line. At this point, somewhere at the base of the seminary ridge, within sight of the seminary, General Doubleday and General Rowley came to welcome the Pennsylvanians. And they welcomed them in a particular manner peculiar to him. If you know anything about Doubleday on the first day, most of the things you know is he had to stop and make speeches for every unit that came on the field. You know, he was kind of like the official greeter on July 1st, 1863. And, of course, here he stops and greets these Pennsylvanians and welcomes them, gives them a speech about how, you know, this battle means a lot, and if we lose this one, you know, we don't have to worry about the next one. So there was that little speech. Rowley, of course, is from Pittsburgh, Thomas Rowley. And he gave them a particular speech about being in Pennsylvania, their native state, and that, you know, these Southerners were carrying on in the most unacceptable way in Pennsylvania, and it was your duty to drive the invader from your native soil. And, of course, this fired the boys up, you know, and they started chanting, "We came to stay. We came to stay." And as they advanced in line of battle over Seminary Ridge, they were still chanting, "We came to stay." And of course, this chant, as it rose in volume, got the attention of the Iron Brigade that was in the woods. And they looked around, and here they see these crazy guys coming across the field. "We came to stay. We came to stay." In fact, some of them are still there in the National Cemetery. All right, so they will fulfill their chant, "We came to stay." But this is a wartime photograph of the Lutheran Theological Seminary. Now, this ridge is McPherson's Ridge. And as they came up, General Biddle's men will arrive after Roy Stone, and his men will go into position here where the road is. Biddle's brigade did not come in the Emmitsburg Road. They took a different route to Gettysburg. They came up, the old Bullfrog Road, if you know where that is, and a road down along Willoughby Run, and for a time were actually behind the Confederate lines. And they were just sitting there on the Fairfield Road behind Harry Heath's division. And of course, if there had been a division commander with some initiative, or if Biddle had known where he was, he could have pitched into the rear of the entire Confederate army, as it was on Hur's Ridge at the time, and might have changed the course of the battle. But he just sat there and waited for orders, and then he found out that he was further advanced than any of the other Union soldiers. So they turned on the old Fairfield Road and marched back to this position. So they were actually in front of the rest of the Union Army. And, of course, as you can see, this position, there's not much cover. There's not much cover on the position. This will be the end of the Union line on July 1st. Now, Roy Stone's troops go into position along the McPherson's farm. And here's a picture of the farm as it existed at the time of the war. And the barn's still standing today, but all the other buildings are gone. This picture is taken essentially from the Chambersburg Pike, looking basically west. If you looked at the left of the picture, you'll see some woods there. And those are the woods in which the Iron Brigade found Confederates on the morning of July 1st. So as Roy Stone's men come up, they take up position at the McPherson farm. Now at this time, the Confederates are about a mile away. And as they see Stone's lines moving forward, they open fire on them. So his men began to attract artillery fire immediately upon arriving on the field. And of course, a lot of them tried to figure out which building they were going to get to hide behind. And a lot of them went to these buildings and tried to find the spot to hide. And as you can see, there's four buildings. Don't pick the one there with the big hole in it, because you could get shot in that one. But the barn's good because it's got a stone foundation. In fact, if you remember the barn from ever being at Gettysburg, most of it's stone anyway. So Roy Stone hides behind the stone barn at McPherson's farm. That's the way the farm looked. Now, of course, this is the way the road looked. This is Route 30. And believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, you were charged to use that road. You had to pay a toll to use that road. There was a guy in Chambersburg who tried to collect the toll from the Confederate Army. As far as I know, they never paid up. And we could fix a lot of potholes in Pennsylvania if we could get those Confederates to pay the toll with interest, you see. But this is the road, and in the distance you can see Hur's Ridge. Hur's Ridge, and that's where the southern line now is taking shape. And up there is a bunch of artillery, and this is taken from essentially where General Buford's monument will go at Gettysburg. And it's sitting right on Route 30. This is an 1880s photograph of the road, And you can see the open nature of the ground there. Look how open it is. So when Stone's men come up to the barn, they're exposed. And the artillery on that ridge, and the one building you see by the road, to the left of the road is Herr Tavern. I'm sure some of you probably have tried the food there at Herr's Tavern. To the left of that ridge now is a development, you see. On the Union line, we have monuments, markers, and memorials, but on the Confederate line, we have fast food restaurants, motels, and condominiums. So I guess the Confederate line's better off today than the Union line because that's high real estate property, you know. Here's a modern view of it. And you see the barn here, the red roof? That's a bar and grill today. They built that to get all the college students out of the bars in town. But that's actually a place where you go get beer and pretzels and tavern fries. But if you look to the right where the cars are, you can barely see Herr's Tavern there, a little brown building to the left of the road. Notice how the road there looks just like the road here, except you can see the road here a lot better than you can see the road there. And this picture is taken from exactly the same place, as near as I can figure it out. So that's the modern view of it. Just to the left where it says one way, that's where the modern guide station is. That little stone house there that sits, and they have all those old relics standing out there waving traffic down. Here's another view of the road, and this is right after the battle. This picture was taken. The little house in the middle of the road was hit by a tractor-trailer truck. That little house was the toll house. That's where you had to stop to pay the toll. And the reason they put it there is because right behind it's Willoughby Run. And Pennsylvanians are pretty smart people when it comes to charging tolls. You ever been on the turnpike? You know? But the thing to keep in mind is they didn't have all these in and off ramps in 1863. But there's one thing that everybody needs to use. The bridge. Right? So all the toll stations were by the bridge. And you could sneak on or off anywhere you want because they can't stop you. But boy, if you want to use that bridge, it's 25 cents, please. And that's where the toll house is. That house no longer exists, of course. There is a house behind the big tree to the left of it that's still standing today. It's still standing today. And that's where the toll keeper lived. He didn't live in that little house. They can't pay him enough money to live in there. But he lived in the big house across the street and made toll house cookies in his spare time. I just wanted to see if you were listening. Now, this is a photograph that's in the Adams County Historical Society. And I believe that the year is 1885. And it's taken of the left flank of the Iron Brigade. This is the 19th Indiana. But if you look beyond the monument, you'll see Willoughby Run. And then you'll see the rise of ground beyond that where the Confederates are. When Biddle's brigade comes on the field, they were ordered to advance from the ridge down to the run. The idea is, you know, these guys fight in lines, and lines are supposed to be connected, you know what I mean? And to be on the ridge would be to be about 200 yards behind the 19th Indiana. So Biddle's men were ordered to march down to that open space across the run were Confederate sharpshooters and skirmishers. And they were in cornfields and in the woods, and they were also in some of the farm buildings that were there at the time. So Biddle's entire brigade moves down to this open area and are terribly punished once they get down there. There are some accounts, of course, if you will. This is an account of a man in the 80th New York. He said the field was alive, and the field he's talking about is that field across the run. The field was alive with them, and them being the enemy skirmishers. He said, in this ravine, and the ravine you see right there, where the run is, in this ravine the brigade found itself under a hot infantry fire and was unable to see the enemy from whom the fire came and did not attempt to reply to it. So they march down there and they stand and get shot at and they don't shoot back. Is essentially what he said. Sounds like a real good idea to me. Gates, who is the commander of the 80th New York, believed that this was an untenable position. And he blamed the position on the division commander at that time, who was Thomas Rowland. And he said, during the fighting on the first day, the general commanding the division, Thomas Rowley, was hardly competent to judge correctly the conditions of things or to know what transpired on the field. In other words, this is a damning indictment of the division commander. Where is Rowley? Well, we're still trying to figure that one out. Rowley, of course, was brought up on charges after the Battle of Gettysburg for his conduct or lack thereof on the first day. And what he was being, shall we say, criticized for was the fact that he had indulged a little bit too much in alcoholic beverage. He was maybe enjoying the battle a little bit too much than he was supposed to. And there were other accounts of him reeling in the saddle. And then, of course, during the retreat, he's going to fall off his horse into Stevens Run. And then that just animated him more, you know. And he was covered with mud, and he was still reeling in the saddle. It's interesting to note that all of those people that complained about his conduct on July 1st were people that were not in his brigade. Now, remember, the 80th New York has only been in the brigade for about a day. So they don't know how Thomas Rowley is. He's reeling in the saddle all the time, you see. He starts early and drinks off. And this didn't seem to, you know, this didn't seem to affect his behavior on other battlefields. But at Gettysburg, he comes under criticism. And then, of course, the 11th Corps will be the ones that prefer charges, because during the retreat through town, Rowley, in his drunken state covered with mud, rode his horse into the middle of the 11th Corps and stopped them at an intersection and allowed his brigade to take the lead. And those 11th Corps guys were upset with him, as you can well imagine, you know. So you can see the 11th Corps didn't run the whole way through the town. They had to stop and let Rowley's men take the lead during the retreat. They were the ones that preferred charges. I have a copy of the court-martial of Thomas Rowley, and they had all his friends on the court-martial review board. All, you know, you name First Corps guys, they're on the review board. Wadsworth, you know, Doubleday, all these guys right down the line. And all of the charges were thrown out except for one. And the one charge that they stuck to him was conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. But all the charges of incompetence and cowardice and drunkenness were shoveled. And then he gets a good job. He gets to go off and sit on court-martial review boards for other people. And then was assigned to defend Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And as I always tell people, we did a great job because the Confederates never got to Pittsburgh. So Thomas Rowley is kind of interesting because he is removed under a cloud after the Battle of Gettysburg. It's interesting also to note that Roy Stone, the other brigade commander, after the Wilderness, is removed under a similar cloud for drunken and disorderly behavior in the Battle of the Wilderness. All right, so these two guys maybe have a little bit too much fun than they're supposed to. But look how open that ground is there. And this is Biddle's position on the field. Now, as they were down in that ravine, the ravine's over where the trees are, they were finally ordered to retreat and move back up onto the ridge where this picture's taken. And as they moved back, the Confederates moved into a farm out in front of the position and were using the building to shoot the people off the ridge. And so General Wadsworth, it was actually Wadsworth that ordered them down there in the first place. Wadsworth, who is the first division commander, he has nothing to do with these guys, but keep in mind, as they take up position, you have Doubleday's division on the left flank, you have the Iron Brigade in the middle, and then you have Roy Stone on the right flank. So Wadsworth's men are there. They're in the middle of Doubleday's division, and he seems to be given most of the orders on July 1st. So he came up the gates of the 20th New York and ordered him to seize that house. So Gates sent a company down back to the Run to take the Harmon farm. That's the farm that was down there at the time. All that's left today is the foundation of it, because the Confederates are going to burn it on July 1st. Eventually, the Confederates tried to drive the Union troops out of the farm, and so another company of the 20th New York was sent down in advance of this position. So he actually had about, 60 Union soldiers in the farm. Guess who else was in the farm? Mrs. Harmon and her daughters. And they didn't like all this excitement around the place, and they were told to go into the basement. Fortunately, they got out before the house burned down around them, but they actually were in the farm at the time of the fighting, so not all the people left. So this is the and they were down there for 2 hours. They're out in front of the Union line for 2 hours in this farm, fighting the Confederates on the other side of Willoughby Run. So it was a position of some danger and importance. Now, of course, Stone's men have the most difficult position. In the woods where the gentleman is pointing is the Iron Brigade. At least they have some cover. This picture is a Matthew Brady photograph. Some of you recognize it. Matthew Brady's the guy on the right taking it all in. And the guy is pointing to where General Reynolds was shot off. So I just saw General Reynolds. He didn't look too bad for being shot on July 1st, 1863. But he's pointing into the woods where Reynolds was hit. These are now known today as Reynolds Woods. But you can see there's those open fields there. And in the background, I think that's the Seminary Ridge over there in the background. Now, here once again is the farm, and I pay particular attention to the fence.
McPherson Farm.
Isn't that a great fence? Mm-hmm. You have to prop it up. And a lot of the fences were that way because after a couple of years of having the post in the ground, it rotted. And all that was supposed to do is let the traffic on the turnpike know that the horses aren't supposed to go in the yard and eat the grass. So all you need is a kind of a fence along there. But along that fence were elements of the 143rd Pennsylvania and the 149th. During the lull in the fighting, as Stone's brigade was taking up position at the McPherson Farm, this gentleman arrived and offered his services to Colonel Wister, the commander of the 150th Pennsylvania. Does anyone recognize him? Yeah, that's John Burns. They supposedly have his musket here in Harrisburg. His War of 1812 musket that wasn't made until 1824. Okay, so if you know that story, then I don't need to elaborate on it. But be that as it may, old John decided to come out and fight. And John was, I think we looked him up. There are 9 John Burns in the War of 1812. So I suspect this is one of them, one of the John Burns. But he didn't see any heavy fighting. He showed up the day after the British left Baltimore. Now, if you want to show up to Baltimore, that's the day to show up, after Fort McHenry's been fired on and the rockets' red glare and all that good stuff. But he was a veteran of the War of 1812. It's just that, you see, he's a little too young to be a soldier. He's nearly 70 years old, and Wister kind of laughed at him a little bit, made him mad, so the guy made up a story about how he's in one of the bloody battles of War of 1812. So Wister sent him in with the Iron Brigade. He said, you go down there and fight with the crazy fellows from Wisconsin. They're in the woods down there. You'll find him. So Burns goes down and fights with the Iron Brigade in the woods and was actually, I guess the 2nd Wisconsin it was, or the 7th, I forget which one it was, actually mustered him in on the field because they didn't want to have insurance claims after the battle if something happened to him. So he was actually made a soldier by the Wisconsin regiment that he served with and later on was given a pension by Congress. But there's a post-war photograph of John Burns. He was wounded 3 times and lived through the fight. But like I said, he was only 69 years old. Abner Doubleday saw him and wrote about him in his report. He said he said over 70. Somehow he got to be 72 all of a sudden. You know, all of a sudden he went from 69 to 72. But you can see he looks, if you say he's 72, he looks it. You can say he's 82, he looks that. He's actually in his late 80s in this photograph. But they have a monument to John Burns at Gettysburg. And the woods behind there is where he went in to fight. Basically, this monument sits on what was the 150th Pennsylvania's line, and the plaque on the front of it is taken from Abner Doubleday's battlefield report, which mentions this old fellow from town that came out to fight. And that report was what was used by Burns to get a government pension after the Battle of Gettysburg. He was given a stipend by Congress, and they also paid for his tombstone, which was put in Evergreen Cemetery, and there's his tombstone. See his wife's Barbara. How's that sound?
I like
That's a good name.
It's a good, strong name.
And Barb wasn't too happy with John because she told him, don't you go out there and get yourself shot. If you do, don't you expect me to come and get you? And that's all she said, and that's all she did. John got home in a junk wagon on July 2nd. That's a hell of a way to treat a hero. But you see, if you go and mess with your wife, that's what you get, you see. John Burns, the date on the stone is 1794. To the left there, under John, it's 1794. And basically that is his birth date. September 5th is the day. So if you figure that out, and you minus 1863, July, you figure out he's 69 years old. He's not 72 or 74 or about 70. He's 69. This is the Evergreen Cemetery, and the distance is Big Round Top. I had to get a picture of the Round Tops in it. You guys be upset with me. So there it is. Take a good look at it. Now, back to the story of the fighting on McPherson's Ridge. As you can see, the line along this ridge, this is a pretty good view, except for the snow, of course, and the modern highway, because there isn't much cover. Biddle's brigade is anchoring the left flank of the Union line on July 1st. And off in the distance is the Peace Light Memorial. And in the afternoon of July the 1st, Confederates come down from the north. They were trying to come to Harrisburg, but the roads were busy, and they couldn't get across the Susquehanna. So they turned around and went back to Gettysburg, you see. These were Jenkins' boys and Rhodes' division, General Ewell's men. Ewell was very upset because he wanted to come to Harrisburg, but General Lee would not let him. General Lee told him, you must come back because the Yankees are coming, and we need your help if we are to whoop them properly, you see. So he was a day away from coming to Hack and attending this program. He was just a day away. If there had been one more day's time, the Confederates would have marched down the center of town, and we'd have had a lot of good stories to tell about that, I'm sure. You know, they'd have pulled that Hart Trap monument down, I'm pretty sure about that. But you see, now you have these Confederates coming in from the north, and I want you to appreciate the problem that the men on this ridge have, except perhaps for the Iron Brigade, because they're in the woods. Biddle and Stone are exposed to fire from artillery from two different directions during this confrontation. And there is a map that you have of the Confederates coming in to the left from the west initially, but then in the afternoon, they're coming in from the north, and those little lines off to the left there in blue are, you know, Doubleday's division and the Iron Brigade, and you see where the rest of the Union line is, it's back from there. So there's three brigades holding McPherson's Ridge on the afternoon. There's the oddly bird-like man. This is General Ewell, and General Ewell is the man who is trying to take Stonewall Jackson's place. He replaced Jackson after the Battle of Chancellorsville. Jackson was shot by his own men. Accidentally, of course, serious one stuff.
Side
you know,
two.
I mean, you get a Jackson biography, it'll fill a bookshelf. Lee will fill a bookshelf. Longstreet's getting there. Where he gets his monument in Gettysburg this year? There'll be two, three, four more books come out on Longstreet. Jeb Stuart is a legend in his own right, who has his own bookshelf of biographies. You know, most of them written by the ladies, of course. But Ewell doesn't have a serious biography, and the speculation is it's because he was so characterized by the historians over the years that nobody takes him seriously anymore. They called him the oddly bird-like man, you see. And he had the beak of a bird and the eyes of an affronted owl, you see. And it got to the point where over the years, when I do my Ewell discussion, I followed the genesis and transition of this story from Dick Taylor, who said that he had peculiar tendencies. He was trying to tell his kids about how strange old Ewell was and what a character he was, you know. And he mentioned that he looked like a woodcock, okay, because he didn't have a picture to show his kids. So he says, you see that bird out there, that woodcock, that's what old Ewell looked like. And from that, historians have run with it to the point where the most recent characterization of Ewell suggests that he didn't only look like a bird, he hallucinated he was one, and would sit and for times and chirp in his tent, and would only take sunflower seeds, you see. I think, you know, historians have gone a little too far with this story of Ewell. But Ewell's men are in a perfect position to make life miserable for the Union Army on July 1st as they come down from the north. Now, this is a photograph of Oak Hill, but you see this line of memorials. This sits back on Seminary Ridge, And this is the rest of the 1st Army Corps taking up position to prevent Ewell's men from getting access to the rear of the Union line. Now, in the distance, look at this view. This is Roy Stone's position. Do you see the monument in the distance? Way up there with a little white slash above the snow? That's the peace light. And that's where Ewell's Rhodes Division comes pouring out of the woods about 12:30, 1 o'clock. And one account said, we heard this thunderous roar to the north. You know, and it was all these Southern boys letting them know they were there, you know, just out of courtesy. Hey, look where we are, look where you are. You're facing the wrong way, you know. So Stone's men are in this hinge. And what Stone had to do then was move men from the barn, where they were fairly secure, and form along the road there in that dip. You had two regiments, 133rd, 149th facing north, and the 150th is facing to the left. Now, the Confederates will attack from that hill. The most famous episode, of course, is Iverson's defeat. And as they're moving off of that hill, you might be interested to find out that as they move forward, the 149th Pennsylvania, which is right there on the other side of the barn along in that low ground that you see, opened fire on Iverson. And as their commander said, he said, we opened, we fired to the limit of the range of our muskets. And our fire on the line, he said, our fire had a tremendous impact on the Confederate line. Yeah, it did. Probably what they saw was those guys being mowed down by Baxter's men, you know. But they fired from here on Rhodes' division. The real problem, however, is Daniels' brigade. And Daniels' men kept coming across that field headed for the barn. So Stone's brigade will take on Daniels' men here on the afternoon of July the 1st.
So the 11th Corps isn't on the field yet at that
point? The 11th Corps is just coming up. Yeah, the 11th Corps is just coming up. And of course, that was part of the problem that Rhodes had. He didn't take into account the 11th Corps being on its flank. The 11th Corps is just coming up at this time, taking up position north of the town in those fields out there where the non-historic Ford garage sits today. Okay. But as Daniel's men came in, the 149th Pennsylvania advanced to meet them. And they advanced to the railroad cut, which is not the railroad cut that everybody goes and stands in, but the one to the left there of where the barn is. There's actually three cuts, two and a half now, but there were three at one time. Here's a picture of the railroad cut that everybody, this is the cut that was torn apart by the college. And then if you look in the distance, you'll see a bridge over a cut. And that's the cut on the morning of July 1st where Davis's men were trapped. And then there's a cut beyond that, but you see McPherson's farm off there to the left. Now, along the Emmitsburg Road is where the 149th Pennsylvania is, and as Daniel's men approached the railroad cut, he advanced into it. The 149th Pennsylvania advanced into the railroad cut and took up position. He said, and I quote from the colonel of the 149th, the men's arms resting on the bank of the cut with orders to take deliberate aims at the knees of the front rank of the enemy as he came up. So as Daniel's men approached the cut, these guys opened fire and did serious execution. Another account says, our men delivered a volley, then crossed the cut, loading as they went, and having delivered another volley, charged, driving the enemy over the fence in confusion. This is the 149th. Daniels will make three attacks on the 149th to drive them off. And on his second attack, Daniel's second attack, the 149th retreated back to the road where you see the farm, and Daniel's men crossed the cut and moved across the cut. The 149th then was ordered again to charge, and they charged across that open ground there and forced Daniel's back a third time. And unfortunately, this time, crossed the cut themselves. And when Daniel's men got reorganized and advanced, they caught the 149th to the right of the cut. And many of the men, when they tried to retreat, ran to the part where the cut's real steep and couldn't get away. And they lost several prisoners and a lot of casualties because they advanced too far over. This is a problem of being new to fighting. You know, the veteran regiment like the 6th Wisconsin, they didn't go across the cut. They advanced to the cut and stopped. But if they were rookies, they'd have been all excited to chasing those Confederates to Richmond before you stopped them. That's the 149th, and they were driven back. Colonel Dwight lamented the fact that one of the problems he had with rallying the regiment was he didn't have the regimental colors with him. And one of the most famous episodes of the fighting on July 1st was the color episode of the 149th Pennsylvania. In order to draw the fire of the Confederate artillery from the unit that was around that barn, no matter which way they turned, they had Confederate artillery firing in on their flanks. He ordered the colors over to the cut, which was about 200 yards to the right of the regiment. He sent the flag carriers over there, and he told them, you guys get over there, wave them things around, and let them see you. And they did that. And guess what happened? All the artillery started firing on those flags. You see why the Yankees won? They cheated. But you see, this is something a veteran unit wouldn't do, because they know those colors are important, because they're the only thing you can see in a battle, and that's what the unit would rally on. If you don't have those flags, you can't control the unit. But Dwight didn't know that, you see. So he sent the colors off, and then forgot they were out there. And then he makes this charge, and the regiment's looking for a place to rally, and there's no flags, and they just went to pieces and came stumbling back across that ground. Dwight still doesn't know where the flags are. You know, they're still out there. There's the color, the two guys carrying the flags, and then the guard that went with them, I think there's like eight guys out there, and they piled up some fence rails to get down behind because they're trapped in all this artillery fire. It was a great idea, at least it worked for a time. As Dwight said after the fighting on July 1st, he said, I saved the regiment but lost the colors. Because when he was forced to retreat, he didn't even order the colors. He didn't even know where they were, and they didn't tell him to run. So those guys are out there the whole time, the Confederates are closing in, and by the time they left, it was too late. Now here you can see the farm, and that's where the 149th was. They were aided by the 150th, and
McPherson's
they were driving Daniel's men out. In that final effort, they drove them back. As Dwight said after the battle, he said, the enemy's dead and wounded completely covered the ground in my front. So it indicates the hard fighting that they had. Now, the problem, of course, is that on the about 2:30, 3 o'clock, the Confederates on Hur's Ridge will begin the attack. This is Harry's second shot at the Union Army. And he brings his men across Brockenbrough's. Virginians will come right at you there where the 150th Pennsylvania is. And of course, Pettigrew's big brigade will be to the left of that as you're looking at the photograph. And they'll strike the Iron Brigade in the woods and Biddle's men on the ridge beyond that. So this is the final assault on McPherson's Ridge. And as you can see here, you can see Riley and you can see this one's actually wrong, this map. That's the trouble you get maps, and none of them are ever right. But there you can see this is the final Confederate advance about 2:30, 3 o'clock on the afternoon of July the 1st. As one soldier said, as Heath advanced to strike the Union position a second time, about 3 o'clock it would initiate the fiercest half hour of fighting in the Battle of Gettysburg, if not in the war itself. And what he's talking about is the fighting for McPherson's Ridge, in which Doubleday's two brigades and the Iron Brigade are participating. The assault. As they move forward, you can see the fences. And this is where the 150th Pennsylvania was waiting for them. I just threw this in because, as you can see, there was a famous painting done of the final defense of McPherson's farm. And there you see the 150th Pennsylvania along the fence. And, of course, the casualties there. It's good to have a fence for rookies because you just say, advance to the fence and stand there and shoot. And that's what they did. This was such an important episode that after the war, Pennsylvania put it on their monument at Gettysburg. And this is the front of the Pennsylvania Monument. And right there is the fence and the barn to the left and the 150th Pennsylvania making its final stand on McPherson's Ridge. Okay. How many of you have been looked at the Pennsylvania Monument and didn't know what that was in the front of it? You're all looking at Nike, aren't you? Yeah, I know how you are. Looking for some tennis shoes. That's what you're looking for. This is the 143rd Pennsylvania making its last stand on Eastern McPherson's Ridge. And there you can see the color sergeant, Sergeant Ben Crippen, of the 143rd Pennsylvania, shaking his fist at the Confederates. And one guy's going to whack him with the gun, and the other one's going to shoot him. So guess what? Don't take a fist to a gunfight. You see, Sergeant Ben Crippen is still missing in action from the Battle of Gettysburg. He probably is still at Gettysburg, and yes, he came to stay, and he did. The flags were recovered, but the color sergeant was not. He was beyond that. There was a great story. I think it was a story. I don't think, but Hill supposedly saw this guy shaking his fist, A.P. Hill, the corps commander of the Confederate Army, and he said it would be a shame if a brave man like that was killed. I think that was, that was a post-war thing. But be that as it may, this brave act attracted attention after the war. And we need a Triani to do this today. You know, he could do it with what, he'd get that same guy he got in all those pictures holding the flag. And even if he didn't look like Ben Crippen, it wouldn't matter, you know. But this is a great color episode of the fighting on July 1st. Now, of course, here's a great photograph. And I took this out of the book that got me interested in the Civil War. This is that American Heritage book, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, this book, I had this book given to me by the librarians in my hometown when I was in the 7th grade. And I'm not going to tell you what year that was, okay? But it was it was just after the war, you know. The war, you know. And they gave it to me because I had two library cards completely full of my library card number, because I kept signing it out as soon as I take it in. They told me I had to leave it sit there, so I take it in and let it sit there for like an hour, and then I go sign it out. B1732 was my library card number, and there were two full cards of it, and nobody else could get the book, so they decided that since I liked it so much, they'd buy me a copy and give it to me so the rest of the town could use their copy. So I still have that copy of the book. But look at that photograph. And it's great stuff. Let me see if I can get up there, because this is the first, this is Doubleday's stuff here. And I apologize because I can't get the original, it's in the private collection. But just to show you what's going on, look right here. Here's an American flag. These are the flags of the 149th Pennsylvania, remember? They were left out there, and when the line collapsed, they tried to make a run for it. This is the guy I know. He knocked that Johnny down. Now, he's not going to last too long, because look at all the other Johnnies coming in. But, excuse me, see the burning farm? See the burning, that's the Harmon farm that I talked about earlier.
Harmon farm is burning in this picture that Charlie's showing.
Here's McPherson's Woods, which was really Herb's Woods, but that's where, Reynolds was shot. And Stone said that as he stood there by the barn and looked, he saw a Confederate battle line that was over 2 miles long. Just rows of battalions, he said, on line with others in reserve. Look at this line. It's just long, long. And here's the Chambersburg Pike. See, here's the old color guard of the 149th Pennsylvania. They didn't make it, nor did their flags. But right here's the Chambersburg Road. Here is Seminary Ridge. Here's the seminary, okay? Here's the railroad college, right there. And here are the Confederates moving finally now. East men have conquered the ridge, and now Pender's troops will move forward and try and take the seminary ridge and continue the Union retreat through. I didn't know much about this picture when I first saw it, but when you tie together what I just told you about Doubleday's division and what they did there, it all fits. I mean, that's a fairly accurate photograph of the final Confederate advance on McPherson's Ridge. So I just thought I'd share it with you. It's still in the book if you want to get a copy of it. It's in a private collection. But there's the view of Seminary Ridge taken from McPherson's Ridge. And right there by that little house, that will become Lee's headquarters, that's where Stone's men take up position. And as they retreated back the Chambersburg Road to that position, there was a peach orchard there at the time, and they turned to face the advancing Confederate line again. And there, their colonel related that the enemy opened with artillery on my right, which would be from Oak Hill. And he said their cannonballs plowed the ground, throwing my men into the air to find when they fell, their graves already open. So they were under intense artillery fire once they got back onto that ridge. The Confederate artillery is also firing, but this will be the last stand of the First Corps. Now, here is a view of Seminary Ridge today. And, of course, those trees you see weren't there then, nor was the snow. But it was a wide open ridge. And on that ridge right there, you have to the right Biddle's Brigade. In the middle, you have the remnants of the Iron Brigade. And then to the left, you have Stone's Brigade right across the pike. And 18 pieces of artillery lined up there just waiting for somebody to shoot at. And Pender's division will come across those fields and advance on the ridge. And as they said, the men, there were only a few. I mean, the First Corps had been terribly shot up as they moved back to that position. And they noticed the roar of artillery. He said it seems like the Confederates didn't pay them any attention at all. They just marched right out in lines in the middle of that field. And one account suggested that the artillery and the fire had just swept the Confederates away. That was probably near the road. Perrin's South Carolinians headed right for the cupola of the seminary, where Biddle's men were taking up position. And as they moved forward, Perrin told his men not to shoot. Just keep advancing. Don't stop the fire. And he rode around behind the line to make sure they complied with the order. They advanced across these fields here. And this is a pretty good representation, like I said, of the open nature of the ground, except for the woods there that mass the seminary. There's a closer view of it. That's the just to the right of the seminary building, where that building is today. That building was in the movie, but it wasn't in the battle. Valentine Hall to the right, if you saw the movie Gettysburg, when Buford was riding around the seminary, they got that building in it. But it wasn't there during the war, you see. And that's where Biddle's men were making their stand. Unfortunately for Biddle, he didn't have enough men to occupy the whole ridge, and so Perrin was able to outflank him and force him to retreat. The first Confederates to pierce Seminary Ridge did so to the right of the seminary building. And they didn't go without some argument, the Union. In fact, the 14th South Carolina, Company K, when they started their advance on the ridge, they had 34 men in the company. When they got to the seminary and the Yankees started running back into town, they had 3 of the 34 men left. And, of course, they stopped and cheered the company just like there was a whole group of them there, and then pursued the Union soldiers back into the town of Gettysburg. So this is where they made their last stand on the ridge. The Lutheran Geological Seminary, as you can see here, is not the theological seminary you thought it was. You notice that? That's a mistake. Yeah, this is a postcard that was done in Germany in about 1904.
Geological seminary.
They didn't know about this theological stuff, so they just put a G down there. And so we have a geological and theological seminary, depending on which picture you see at what time. But there's an old
picture of
the dorm where they made their last stand. Now, here's the town of Gettysburg. All you got to do is get through it, okay? And as it went down, Roy Stone's men were right down this road. And Ramseur's North Carolinians were just to the left of that building you see in the front. And he said, we fired on them as fast as we could, and they paid no attention to us at all. You know, they just kept running. They just didn't want to fight anymore. They're running back through town. So Ramseur was saying basically the retreat now resembled a rout, as the Union soldiers had enough of the fighting that they were running. See, they're running to the tower in the distance. You see that tower sitting over there? The little thing sticking up? It's a much bigger tower now because it grew over the years. But that's actually a big tree on Cemetery Hill that no longer stands. But that's where the lucky Union soldiers are going to wind up. They're going to wind back at that tree because that sits right across from the gatehouse at Cemetery Hill. Now, the trick is trying to get there through the town with people shooting at you. And, of course, the Union soldiers, Biddle's men and others, are trying to get through the town the best they can. And as one guy said, we'd never heard of Gettysburg before. We didn't know how to get through town, and furthermore, they didn't come through town to get to where they were in the first place. So this was a whole new experience to them, one that they didn't necessarily enjoy. This is the street going, this is Middle Street going into town, and this is where Biddle's men ran into the town. You can see there's a big open area between the seminary ridge and the town of Gettysburg at the time of the battle. And here's another view. This is Springs Avenue right here, coming out of the town to the seminary. But once again, a wide open view and going down the street. Down this street is where they're going to have some problems. There's the town of Kinsler. Look at that. What do you think of that? That's a 1928 aerial view. Yeah, the guy had wax wings on, he's flapping away, and there's a guy on his back taking pictures. Now this is a, sorry, I couldn't resist. This is a U.S. Army official aerial reconnaissance view of Gettysburg. Because the U.S. Army until 1933 held maneuvers in the Gettysburg area. They would bring, you know, they'd have like, you know, regular war games on the battlefield.
That's probably how Eisenhower got so interested in it, huh?
Yes, well, Eisenhower was actually sent to Gettysburg in 1917, and he commanded the camp that was established there to train men to drive tanks.
Oh.
You're welcome, okay? So that was the beginning, sorry. That was the U.S. Army Tank Corps. That's where it was created. Now, of course, it's Fort Hood, which is in Texas, but the original tank base of instruction was Camp Colt, Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And this is a great view because you can see the square. And you can see in the distance, that's Cemetery Hill at the top of the photograph. See it? And there's no McDonald's there. And there's no Kentucky Fried Chicken or Wax Museum in 1928. And there's no Holiday Inn there, you see. And no Sheetz convenience store. Okay, so once you get through the town, you're out in the open area there for a little while. And they get back. You can actually see a few monuments there on Cemetery Hill, if you look carefully. And notice also to the left, that open field, that's where the football stadium is today. There's no school district there either in 1928. So as they get into this jumble of buildings and streets, many of them got confused and wound up being captured in the town. And one of the flag of the 150th Pennsylvania was captured right by this building. This is the, for lack of a better term, I call it the Kennedy House because they own it. This is the one that missed John. You see, that's an artillery round stuck in the wall of the building. And this was where the college and both the seminary got its start. And on the street corner, the flag of the 150th Pennsylvania was captured because the color bearer couldn't go anymore and he just sat down. And he was captured along with the flag as the Confederates rushed into the town and gobbled him up. This is Washington Street. And down this street, this is where, you know, Riley stopped the 11th Corps and let his men take the lead down this street. And if you go down the street, you'll wind up being at the Tommy's Pizza. You know where Tommy's Pizza is, right?
Yep.
And this is the one that goes right up into the Tawny Town Road, right up into the cemetery. So this is how Biddle's men, at least, got back through the town and some of Roy Stone's men as well. The retreat was anything. As one guy said, we didn't cover ourselves with honor during the retreat through the town of Gettysburg. But they did manage to get through the town. This is Stratton Street. This is an 1863 photograph. That's the German Reformed Church. And this was the edge of town at the time. And then, of course, you see the open nature of the ground there. And there's that big tree. In the distance. This is where the school district sits today, right out in front of it. So once again, much more open. Once they got back to the cemetery, they were safe for the time. They were able to form lines up there and go into position. The gatehouse, and this is where Riley got into trouble because he's ordering everybody to go into position. He's even ordering Doubleday to move men here and there. And as Doubleday said, he was acting as if he was in command of the First Corps, not me. So this is what Doubleday testified at the court-martial held after the battle. But this is a August 1863 view of the gatehouse on Cemetery Hill. And this is where Riley rallied his division. Doubleday's division rallied around the gatehouse and then were sent off onto another portion of the line. Now this map shows you the heavy fighting on July 1st. This is a soon-to-be released to the public Park Service computerized version of the fighting on July 1st. Where it is pink, there was heavy fighting. Where it is kind of yellow, dark yellow, there was moderate fighting. And where there is pale yellow, there was light fighting. And where there is no color at all, there is no fighting at all. How's that sound? You see? And the idea is here, you can see where, the pink there to the left is the first core line, and of course Doubleday's division right in the center of it. As some of you are aware, of course the Park Service is attempting to build a new visitor center. And so they're putting together a bunch of these maps to show the public that where they're going to build it, there are no pink, dark yellow, or pale yellow colorations. So that they're going to build the thing where there was incidental contact. You know how that is in the NBA. Incidental contact. So these are the maps, and like I say, they have never been released to the public. They soon will be, so if you're interested in those, keep your eyes open for them. Okay. Now, let's have the lights. I bet we can't get the lights on now. That we didn't get them off. But I just wanted to conclude with something from the casualties of Doubleday's division. What division suffered the highest losses in the Battle of Gettysburg? Wadsworth's division. So you guys were going to say Doubleday's, yours. Yeah. Wadsworth, simply because he was there first, but guess what division suffered the second highest losses? On the Union side, that's right. Yeah. Doubleday, that's right. I should have qualified that. You're right. Doubleday's. The unit that suffered the highest losses numerically in the Battle of Gettysburg on the Union side was the 24th Michigan. They suffered 363 losses. The unit that suffered the second highest numeric loss in the Battle of Gettysburg for the Union, the school teachers' regiment, those guys soon to be mustered out to go to Juniata and write their memoirs, they suffered 337 losses. Most of these are on July 1st, by the way. The unit that suffered the third highest losses in the Battle of Gettysburg was the 149th Pennsylvania, the 1st Regiment of Bucktails, and they suffered 336 losses. They were going to shoot a couple more guys so they could get ahead of the 151st, but they couldn't get them to stand still for it. So there you have the top three units in the Union Army that suffered losses. Two of them are in Doubleday's division. And one of them was that big schoolteacher's regiment that they were worried about wasn't going to fight. You go down the list of the top 10. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. In the top 10, two more of Doubleday's regiments show up. The 150th Pennsylvania, 264 losses in the Battle of Gettysburg. And the 143rd Pennsylvania, Ben Crippen's regiment, they lost 253 men in the Battle of Gettysburg. So I think, you know, just numbers alone seem to suggest very strongly that Doubleday's division played a conspicuous part in the fight. So that's what I wanted to show you. I hope you enjoyed it. I didn't know how you'd take seeing snow on the battlefield of Gettysburg, but, you know, considering this morning's weather, I thought it was kind of appropriate as it was. Does anyone have any questions? Yes.
When Reynolds came on the field, it would seem that he had two choices. He could have come up and, you know, posted his corps in support of Buford, or he could have posted his corps up on Cemetery Ridge itself. Now, Buford, as the movie conveys, was trying to buy some time in order to protect that high ground on Cemetery Ridge. Why do you think that Reynolds didn't put his corps up there as opposed to coming up to support Buford? And why didn't he then have Buford withdraw?
Okay, the question is, why did Reynolds put his men where he did? And I think there's two reasons. Number one, he wanted to have room to maneuver. So he wanted to put his men as far out as he could. That would give him, you know, places to fall back in eventuality. That's just good, you know, soldiering. The other thing is, the reason I think is because the roads are more important, at least initially, than the hills are. And to protect the roads that converge at Gettysburg, you got to be out of town. To sit back on Cemetery Hill is to yield that critical road junction. So I think that those are the two contributing factors to why Reynolds moved his men out on McPherson's Ridge. I, however, believe that if Reynolds had lived, he wouldn't have left them there. That he would have, once Ewell's men arrived to the north of town, he would have seen it in his best interest to move those men at least back to Seminary Ridge so that they weren't under enfilading fire as they were during the fighting. But that's speculation. Howard felt that he was fighting the battle that Reynolds would have fought had he lived. And he was much more inflexible as to Doubleday's suggestions that I should pull my men back if we're not going to take Oak Hill. He said, no, you hold that ground to the last extremity, because basically this is what Reynolds told him the night before. We'll fight in the town. We'll fight building to building if we have to, but we're not going to give up an inch of ground. And that was Reynolds, you know, speaking the night before the battle. And that's the battle that Howard fought. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
What's your evaluation of Doubleday as a commander?
I think Doubleday, Doubleday, of course, gets a bad reputation after, you know, he's relieved after the battle. The reason being, of course, is that Howard wrote a letter to me suggesting that the 11th Corps was in disarray, or excuse me, the 1st Corps under Doubleday was in disarray, and he said it didn't seem to be there was anyone in charge, indicating that Doubleday wasn't doing a very good job. This was unfair criticism. Doubleday fought a good battle. If there's any criticism about Doubleday at all, most of it is that he held too long. That he held too long. You know, you'd like to have that kind of criticism, I think, if you're a commander in the Army of the Potomac, because the assumption is you don't hold long enough, right? So I think he did a good job. But because of these comments by Howard and the fact that Meade didn't like him as a person, he didn't have any time for Doubleday whatsoever. Doubleday, because of Meade's position in the Army, was eased out of it in the reorganization under Grant and was given administrative posts.
What magic stone did Howard have in his pocket? I mean,
I don't know, and if you find out, you let me know. Because Howard, he's asked me, what magic stone did Howard have in his pocket? And I don't know, other than the fact that Howard screws up in every battle he's ever in and gets promoted. You know, and... I don't know why, other than the fact that maybe he screws up so bad the guys want to get rid of him, and you know the old government way of getting rid of you is promote you up and out. And so, you know, something rises to the top and it isn't the cream. But that's the story of Howard. He goes from one unmitigated disaster to another and gets another star out of it. And it even continues after the war. You know, the Nez Perce campaign was a Howard fiasco, too. You find out the magic stone, you let me know. Somebody must have owed Howard a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, of course, he did get the dirty jobs, you know, and he was a loyal subordinate, and he was without any political ambition, at least for the presidency or anything, so he was somewhat innocuous in that way. Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
Why do you think Lee allowed two of his corps to get so heavily engaged on the first day when he didn't intend to fight a general engagement that day?
Well, I think General Lee was caught by the problem that he wasn't in contact with those commanders. And it's just the old story of communication in the Civil War. If he had a walkie-talkie, the battle would have occurred differently. Well, I better let you go. Make sure you fill out your evaluation. You're supposed to put them in the box.